This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. At the recent meeting of Renegade University in Los Angeles, we had the pleasure of speaking with my old friend Daniele Bolelli, who is the host of the very popular, very successful podcast History on Fire. Daniele and I talked about some of the great renegade figures from American history that I've actually neglected in my own writing. We talked mostly, though, about things like loneliness, about the relationship between the individual and society, about death and loss, about community, and about what it means to build your own tribe. And we have another Renegade University weekend coming right up. That's March 15th, 16th, and 17th in Washington, D.C., and this time it'll be featuring my friend Camille Foster of Freethink Media and the Fifth Column Podcast. For more information and to buy tickets for that weekend with me and Camille Foster in Washington, D.C., go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. But right now, this is my interview with Daniele Bolelli and members of Renegade University. This is my good friend Daniele Bolelli, who I met in 2010 or 11, right after my book was published. His mother interviewed me. She's an Italian journalist living in Los Angeles. She interviewed me for one of the major newspapers over there because I had just done this book. And we're sitting in this cafe, and I said, "So how do you know about me? You're an Italian woman. What the hell is this?" She said, "Oh, my son, he found your book and he's a fan and he told me about you." And I said, "What's your son's name?" "Daniele." "Oh, and he teaches history at Santa Monica College right down the street." I said, "I need to meet this guy." Because at that point, I knew no one. I had nothing. I had just been divorced. I was alone in LA. I had no friends here. I had not much of a career. I had no platform, no podcast, no nothing really. Broke as fuck. We were stealing food to survive, actually, for a little while, supporting our children. We both had small children at the time. His wife died right after I met him, and he became a single dad right then. We were both being turned down for academic jobs right and left in all kinds of places. We could not find a real career in the academy, struggling as adjuncts, under a lot of pressure, and I wasn't as much as you were, but we were both going under a lot of shit together at that time, trying to figure out if we can even have a career doing this stuff. Talking about history, writing about history, thinking about ideas and philosophy and all this stuff. And we did not know. I remember sitting in my flea-bitten little house over there on Granville Street, and I remember the day we were like, "What the fuck are we gonna do, man?" And that was when podcasting had just really started. And Daniele, you got on Rogan first, right? Mm-hmm. That was before Rogan was even big. That big.
It was the end of 2011.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Rogan was like 2011, just getting big then. He got on first, and I think that sort of paved the way for me. But I remember sitting there at that cafe talking to you, and then you started to refer to your wife in the past tense. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I had just met him like a few weeks before, and she died. It happened very fast. And we had been talking for an hour, and you suddenly referred to her in the past tense, and my jaw just dropped. I didn't even know she was sick. And I found out that she had died, and suddenly your whole life was turned upside down. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Sure.
You've written books about it, so I think it's okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's life, right? It's just nothing. One of the things that's always puzzling is how little control we have on things. You know, you can be... It's actually funny because one of the topics that we're going to jump into in history in a little bit is very much related to this, because we're going to chat at some point about Lakota leader Crazy Horse And to me, that archetype is so, it speaks to me, because you have the archetype of this guy who's sort of like a Native American version of Marvel's Punisher. You know, the guy is a beast. He cannot be touched in battle. He's like the most badass warrior you can think of. And there's not one damn thing he can do to save the ones he loves. He sees everybody he cares about die. His way of life goes down to shit. And it's like there's that paradox between having so much personality, so much intensity, so much even ability to affect things within this range. But once you step out just the boundary of your own body by a tiny bit, life happens whether you like it or not. And there's a shit that there's nothing you can do about. And it's both... I mean, on one end, that's reality, right? It's like it wakes you up to the fact that, you know, if you have any illusions of control, well, good luck. Have fun, because you don't control shit at the end of the day. On the other element, you do control this right now. You know, just what's within range in the here and now. That's pretty much the only place where you have any kind of power. Where there's a Zen story that I dig about that. That's... it's the story of this guy who's not having the best day of his life. You know, he's in the middle of the forest, happily minding his business, and he realized that a tiger is stalking him. And he's like, oh shit, tiger. Runs off, managed to outrun the tiger by a bit, get to the edge of this cliff. And he's like, what now? Hang on to a vine, start lowering himself down the cliff a little bit. The vine is not long enough to make it down, but at least he's not getting eaten for the moment. So that's a start. You know, he's hanging there thinking, okay, what do I do now? You know, it's like... he looks down, and because his day is not shitty enough already, he sees another tiger coming at the bottom of the cliff. So just in case he had any illusions that he could jump and maybe he doesn't break all his bones and he could pull it off, no, there's a tiger who's gonna eat you down there. So he's like, okay, that complicates my options a little bit. Again, because his day is not shitty enough already, a couple of mice come out and begin to munch on the vine that he's hanging on. So he's like, okay, this is great. As all of this is happening, he sees this biggest, ripest red strawberry he has ever seen, just barely out of reach of his arm, just out there. And, you know, he's thinking, you know, I could swim myself, but it's already this thing, I don't know how well it holds. If I swim myself, the odds are even worse that I may fall, or what do I do? You know, and the whole story is set up with what's going to happen next. And then there's just one line at the end of that thing that say, referring to the strawberry, how sweet it was. Doesn't say what happened. Because, of course, there is no happy ending. Right? The guy's not going to get out alive. It's a shitty moment. There's no getting out. But for that one moment, god damn, that strawberry tastes good. And to me, that's what I mean by what you can touch and what you can... have an impact on. You know, you can, even though you don't control some of the most important things that happen in your life, you may have a control over what you do 10 seconds from now with the person that's right next to you, that you have power on, that you can do something powerful there. That's it. Past that point, you probably don't. And so dealing with that is one of the things that, if I'm in a good mood, I'll take it as a cool existential moment of being able to live in the moment and be in the here and now and enjoying here and now. If I'm not in a good mood, I'm like, doom and gloom, you don't control shit in life, and the universe one day is just going to squash you and that's it. So depending on which day you catch me on, may lean more one way or another.
To be fair, you and I are usually grumpy, though.
Well, it varies. Yeah.
And usually when I talk to you, you're tired.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
And usually when you talk to me, I'm pissed off.
Right.
So, but I love that, though. When I moved to LA, as I said, I moved here from New York with my wife at the time and my son, who was 7 at the time. But after 9 months, I left my wife and I was alone in Los Angeles and with my son half the time. But really, I knew no one until I met this guy. So like, he was the only actual personal contact I had. The only way I could be Zen in that way socially was with him. He was my strawberry. He was the only thing I had. He was the only thing I had for a long, long time. And in some ways, I think like you were just like that life raft. You know, I felt like I was just out in the ocean, and then finally this guy read my book and he wanted to talk to me and be my friend, and there he was. And I, from there, like, we just started building. We had nothing. Neither one of us had shit. We had a couple of books that no one read, and that was it. And we just started building. Daniele Bolelli now has one of the biggest, hottest podcasts there is. His audience is way bigger for History on Fire than it is for Unregistered, than there is for Unregistered. It's a magnificent piece of work. If you've ever listened to it, just the scholarship, the research, and then the clarity of the communication and the drama he builds into every moment is the reason he has built an audience in the six figures. So he has gone from where he was in 2011 with me on my couch that I pulled from the street with a dead wife and a baby girl, daughter, to where he is now. So he's a big shot in the podcasting world. He's educating 1,000 times more people than almost any professor in this country. So we don't want your jobs anymore anyway.
Right.
Okay. And he also has a girlfriend who's fairly decent at a certain thing known as cage fighting. This is Savannah.
Oh, yeah.
This is Daniele's girlfriend, who is now 3-0 as a professional fighter. She just beat the living shit out of a poor girl in, where was it? Oh, Kuala Lumpur. Uh-huh. So she travels the world beating the shit out of women. No, she's a professional fighter, and that's what she does. And she's training, and Daniele is a former professional fighter, by the way. No one knows this. He's 2-0 as a professional.
Good time to retire, right?
Yeah.
2-0. Done.
Perfect record, baby.
Undefeated.
You'll always be undefeated.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly.
And so we bonded over that. I had just begun martial arts when I met him. He was already well advanced. But so he's living a really different life, and so am I. But I feel a bond and a gratitude for having him there at the very beginning of this. So that's one of the reasons he's here. But it's not the real reason. The real reason he's here is that the dude has so much to teach me, and I've learned so much from him about even what I study. So we're going to talk about American history. And when we were just going over in the back room about what we talk about here, I didn't know much of what he had said to me. And I've been, I don't know if you're aware, I'm a professional American historian. This is what I've been doing for 30 years now professionally. You'll see there's a lot of overlap in our interests, but also some divergences just in sort of our interests and priorities. And one of his main priorities as a scholar, and I think politically and otherwise, mm-hmm. has been an interest in what are now called Native Americans. And he's a historian of Native Americans, something I know very little about, actually. It's another reason I wanted him to come here, because he fills in a big hole in my own knowledge and what I can teach. So you're from Italy. You're from Milan. You got here as a teenager. What were you, 18?
Yep.
And so why on earth do you care about Indians?
You know, that is weird. I don't really know, in the sense that it goes so far back that it's before I can remember. It's like I was like super little kid, and you know, some things catch your attention, you know, whatever little kid book somebody put in front of you. I don't even remember what it was. I don't know what the origin point was, but there was something at an age before I can remember that caught my attention when it came to Native stuff. And then, so every memory I have of me as a kid, that origin was in the past. Is at some point, who knows where, I don't know, I was 2, 3, 4, something like that. And I don't know what that initial thing was. So whatever memory I have, there has been already this interest in Native stuff. So I can't really go back to a time when there wasn't.
Okay, so let me ask you the harder, more interesting question. Sure. Why do you care now about Native people?
I think one of the things that fascinated me about Native cultures was this idea of living in a society where you're living with essentially extended family, friends, you know, maybe a few hundred people, where it's still manageable to have individual relationships with people, where you don't live in a society where there are so many people that it's, you can keep track of everybody, where it's a functioning community. It's, you have a closer relationship to your food, to the land, to the basics of life, you know, to the earth under your feet, to what you're gonna eat, to all of that. And there's no state. There's no super level above here. The only level that exists is your tribe, is that relationship that you build with those 200, 300, 400 people around you. To me, that's human life. You know, that's the 99% of the time we've been around. I mean, tribes of hunters and gatherers long time ago were smaller, you know, because they didn't have horses. So you're talking more about 10 to 50 people as opposed to 300 or 400. 300 or 400 sound more fun. You're not stuck with the same 30 people all the time. You know, at least it's like gives you a little extra variety. So I like that better than the caveman version. But I do like the fact that we're talking about what essentially is the human experience for 99% of the time that human beings have been around has been that, has been a tribal experience, close to the land, close. And I find that it speaks to me, you know, it speaks to me in the sense that some of the things that today I miss, and it's funny that I miss because it's not like I ever had them, you know, but that in my mind, I'm like, I would like that life are tied to start with the idea of having a sense of community, you know, that I dig. I dig the idea of a community that yet allow you to be an individual. And that's the boundary, right? Because, of course, community sometimes end up squashing your individuality, and being completely individual cut you off from any sense of larger human connection sometimes. So finding that sweet spot is fascinating. It sounds awesome. It sounds beautiful. It sounds... And I think it, in some way, it speaks, beside what it does for me personally, in terms of where we are as a society today, this idea, one of the big diseases that are going on in people's brain a lot is a monstrous amount of loneliness that exists today, just because of the way society is structured, that, you know, you go home, you mind your business, you see your friends once in a while, and we're not wired that way. You know, it's like our DNA has been built on generations and generations and generations and generations of people living in this close-knit community. And suddenly, in a relatively fast period of time, everything has changed. Today, even more extreme than 100 years ago, where it had already changed. So those themes intrigue me. And, you know, you can take it in a bunch of directions, whether in terms of relationship with your food, your relationship with the earth, but also relationship with other human beings.
Yeah. So we've talked about this before, but I am very taken by your description of what you call tribal existence. Mm-hmm. The reason I have sort of not been terribly interested in natives mm-hmm. as a scholar and politically is you changed my mind a lot on this, but I'm still holding. Here's the two problems I've had with it, okay? This idea of tribes. Now, we actually this weekend have been talking about just this, right? And about how in the podcasting world, right? Mm-hmm. I think what's been going on is the development and cultivation or emergence of various tribes around podcasts, right? So, you know, Rogan is the leader of a particular kind of tribe. There's a particular way of thinking. There's an ethos. There's a language even around Rogan. I mean, it's not organized, but it's essentially tribal in that way. Plus, try criticizing him in public and see what happens, right? People defend him on sort of in a tribal way, right? Sort of a non-thinking way. And that goes for anybody. I'm not Rogan, right? Anybody who's a head of a tribe or seen as a head of a tribe gets defended by every member of the tribe in that way, which is something I do not like, okay? The other issue I've had with it, and we'll get into this, mm-hmm. and I know you have a very sophisticated, interesting answer that did sway me quite a bit, but is that when you talked about connection to the earth, I get very restless right away because I feel like at least what's been handed down is an understanding, or at least we have seen the natives as being, and this is a good word, tied to the earth.
Sure.
Right. And that's how at least they're presented, right? Mm-hmm. Is that they are of the earth, tied to the earth. They are of this place. And so anytime you trespass upon it, you are violating some sacred right of theirs to this place on which now that sounds to the liberal mind wonderful. And that's why, in fact, we should support them. To me, it actually sounds like incarceration. So in my world, if you tell me that I am not allowed to leave a particular or should not leave or cannot leave a particular piece of earth, you're telling me that I am in prison, right? And so I don't want to be tied to any place or even necessarily any people. We were talking about were we our tribe, this if this is a tribe that right here we have, it's an open borders tribe. Mm-hmm. You can come and go whenever you want. And then the third issue with it though, is not anything that you said. It's three letters that often gets attached to the word tribal, which are ISM. So tribalism mm-hmm. is a real problem. So this phenomenon of defending at all costs the head of your tribe, no matter what he does or what he says, that's tribalism, right? That's non-thinking. Defending the tribe, if it makes some internal mistake against outsiders, no matter what the mistake is, that's tribalism. To me, it's simply non-thinking, reactive existence. And it's I hate that. I want to avoid that. I don't want to be involved with any tribe like that. And I know you don't either.
Sure.
But I'm pretty sure that there were at least some native tribes that did operate in those particular ways and others that maybe didn't. So maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, the dark side of any small community is that is usually pretty good to members, not so sweet toward non-members. And it's one of the things where it can really go two ways. Like, for example, that's one of the things that I find fascinating about some native cultures is that, let's say, during war, they raid another community, capture some people. This, by the way, varies. I'm totally generalizing because it changes from one particular tribal nation to another. It's not like they all have the same customs. But if you look at, like, for example, Northeast cultures out there, you would raid, capture somebody. It can really go one of two ways. You know, the over-romanticized view of native only remember one side. The super negative, these guys are a bunch of savages, only remember the other side. The fact is, they were both. And the thing is, people, let's say you got captured or for whatever reason you end up being part of the tribe. You're not yet part of the tribe, rather. You are a captive of the tribe. It can go one of two ways. They check you out for a while. If they like you, then you can be adopted into the tribe. You can become, and not like literally adopted, like you take somebody's place as a family member. You know, somebody, their brother died or their kid died or something, and you become that person to them. It's like they treat you like that. They love you to death. They would do anything for you. That's sweet. That's very cool. And in fact, in that sense, there was interesting enough with native tribes, there wasn't really much of a concept of race there. So there were like, people who end up becoming huge important figures within a tribe where not one drop of Indian blood, you know, were black, were white, were Mexican, were could be whatever. Like they did not care in terms of race. They care in terms of you are an insider or you are an outsider to that community. It was not based on skin color. It was based on you're either a member or you're not. Now that's the good case if they like you and they adopt you. And still on the good side, showing you that this process really worked. Most of the time, whenever, let's say, some white guys got kidnapped by a tribe, they were eventually adopted into the tribe. 2 years later, the army come around and is like, okay, we're here to save you. Most of these guys didn't want to go back to white society. They were like, thanks, but I'm pretty happy here. You know, it's like, I got it made. This is a good life. I don't want to come back.
It's called going native.
Literally, right? And there was like a Benjamin Franklin quote that said, there's no European who has tasted savage life can afterwards bear to, I forget the exact wording, I think bear to come back to live in our settlements or something.
Franklin said that?
Yeah. And
the man who built the damn thing?
Well, but that's the thing. It's like this guy, he was totally puzzling to the ones on the outside.
Why would these white people turn down what we've built for them?
Exactly.
Look at this beautiful palace known as civilization. And yet they prefer to roll around in the dirt with those savages.
It's basically, it puzzled them. It's like, we are a superior civilization, but a bunch of our people want to live with them and none of them want to live with us.
How could they?
Exactly, right?
Because our way of living is so clearly, obviously, objectively, scientifically proven to be better. The science part, that proves that we invented that. But anyway, so we know for sure and deep in our hearts that we live better than they do. All right.
So that was the good part, yeah. Right? That's if they like you. And there's something there that tells you that there's something about that kind of living that speak to human beings, that even people who may have not grown up with it, when they are brought in, they fucking love it, right? This is amazing. This is, I don't want to go back to my old life. This is better. Well, this is what would give rise to the more romanticized version of it all. Because it's real, but it's one side of the story. The other side of the story is we don't like you, and in which case we'll just torture you to death. And it's like, oh shit, that's not Dances with Wolves. That's a little harsher, you know. And it's like, and it's the same people, right? The same guy would give his life for you and love you and adore you as a family member. On a different day, would instead torture to death the person they kidnap because the person doesn't make the cut. He's not going to be an insider. And again, it's not about skin color. It's about, for whatever reason, maybe you are a bit too aggressive in resisting. Maybe they don't feel that they can trust you. Maybe they don't feel, maybe they just, you smell bad. Who the hell knows, right? Something that they don't like you for. You're like, sorry, you didn't make the cut. You die in a horrific way. And it's the same culture, right? And it's like, so what do you make of it? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Well, you know, life is complicated, right? You can really, it's both. It's horrific and terrible. And it's amazing at the same time. And it's, but it speaks to me about that process of what it means to be. So yeah, on the dark side, being part of a tribe in that sense is not a very friendly worldview in terms of outsiders. You know, people who are not, that we don't make peace with, who are either not part of our tribe or at least that we have a friendly relationship with, as you guys are from the other tribe, but we're cool with you. Anybody who is not in that category might as well just burn in hell for all they care, right? Because it's just, there's the same degree of love and compassion does not extend to somebody just because they are a human being if they are not part of the deal.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying there's some circulation between tribes. There aren't hard national borders like there are now, right? Yeah. And so I think what you showed me, I think, is that there is something in the native past that is actually possibly usable now, that at least for my purposes could be useful in establishing new forms of community that are open.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk about this crazy guy named Crazy Horse.
Yes.
So first of all, I was just thinking, how did he get that name?
Crazy Horse. Well, there are all sorts of theories, but one is his father actually had the name Crazy Horse at some point. That's one version that it gets to be passed along in the family. But then one is that he has this vision in which there's this horse that acts in an odd kind of way, moving in this unusual, unconventional, weird way, crazy horse, right? So, but again, like most of these things based on oral history, there are like 10,000 different versions of the same tale, and who knows which one is the real historical. But
there was a
one.
Horse that was moving in crazy ways.
Yes.
In somebody's mind, or they saw a horse that was moving in crazy ways, which tells me it was a horse that was not yet broken.
Right.
Is that correct?
Again, it's in a vision, so who the fuck knows what's happening.
But he was an unbroken horse.
Sure.
So crazy means unbroken.
Yeah, and it fits also with the guy's personality, because even within a Lakota context, he was not a normal kid. You know, he had, partially because of grief, you know, his mom hanged herself when he was 5 years old. He stopped speaking for 3 years. And so clearly there was some harsh developmental stuff there at some point. And then they say that he would often not talk. He would talk very little. He would hardly talk with adults. He would chat with kids, no problem. He would have no problem play with them. He was in a culture that kind of likes this macho vibe of like, I'm the toughest warrior there is. We put on the war paint. We do all these cool things. We tell everybody what badass things we have done on the battlefield. Crazy Horse was a very soft-spoken guy who said little, who didn't boast much, who kept it very... So it was very easy to overlook him. Like, he's just a weirdo. You know, he's got some... Except for the fact that when battle time came... he could do things no one else could. So it kind of forced, he's almost the archetype for the strong, silent type, you know, the one who doesn't talk much at all to the point of being weird. Mm-hmm. And yet he can do things that objectively everybody has to take notice and go like, holy shit, look at this guy, what he can do.
So can you just situate him in the context right now, just so we know where we are and when we are?
Sure. He was born in 1840. In the area of the Great Plains. So somewhere probably, there's probably South Dakota. That's the belief of where he was at the time. His band, you know, being nomadic people, they were all over the place. They were South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, Colorado, all of that area, right? But yeah, he was born around 1940, died by...
1840.
I'm sorry, 1840, yes. Died by 1877. So... that's the time frame that we're looking at.
Did you notice that? He dies in 1877. You know what 1877 is? It's the end of Reconstruction. So we'll get to that in a second. This is important here. So he's Lakota.
Mm-hmm.
He's in the Great Plains in the 1840s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s.
Yep.
That's when he's operating. Strong, silent type. Doesn't talk much. Has some violent tendencies, apparently, though.
Yeah.
Very masculine in particular ways. Yeah. Good at fighting, apparently. Keep going.
Definitely say that. And, you know, he lives at the time, he's born at the time when the Lakotas are super powerful. And he's kind of at the height of that lifestyle of living in teepees, chasing the buffalo herds. You know, the Lakotas have it made at the time. They have the best of both worlds. They have the cool life of being a hunter and gatherer, but they have horses, so they can do it on a much larger scale. More people around, more resources. It's the coolest life there is. Well, except when somebody comes to kill you at night from a rival tribe. But, you know, that's part of the... Other than that, pretty cool life. But it's coming at the time when U.S. is expanding westward. And so by the 1850s, they are knocking on the door on the plains and beginning to make things a little rougher. You know, with the discovery of gold in California in 1848 was discovered. 1849 is the gold rush. You have a shitload of people wanting to travel from the east across the plain. The U.S. come in, offer a deal to the tribes like, hey, do you guys, we'll pay you. We'll give you blankets, we'll give you knives, we'll give you a bunch of gifts if you let our settlers travel through your lands unmolested. And the tribes are like, fair enough, we can do that, you know, that's cool, we can... And it's okay for a while, but the sheer number of people traveling west are becoming an issue. They are cutting too much of the firewood, that there's not that much on the plains. Their cows are grazing too much of the grass and is disrupting the migration of the buffalo herds, so... Things are getting a little diseases, of course. You know, these tribes have not been in touch with white people as much. Now they're exposed to European diseases. They start dying like flies. The Lakota are beginning to rethink this idea of, yes, we should let you drive through our lands, no problem. It's like, okay, this is beginning to take a toll on our lifestyle that's heavy. But of course, that's not going to stop anytime soon. And so that's where inevitably you can see they are on a collision course. It's just a matter of when. And, you know, one of the first major fight between the Lakota and U.S. happened in 1854. So when Crazy Horse is like a young teenager or something, he's there, he sees the bloodshed, he sees the whole thing. And the rest of his life will be spent from that time to 1877 will be spent partially fighting intertribal wars with other tribes and partially fighting against the United States. And that's, of course, is a losing battle, right? You know, nobody has any illusion that they are going to win. You know, it's like they are... The Lakotas are probably 30,000 people at this time. Of course, they're going to get crushed. Kind of reminds me, like, if you watch, like, Lord of the Rings, there's that sentence that they use to describe the elves' path through. They say, they talk about it as the long defeat. You know they are going to lose. There's no question about the ultimate outcome, but, hey, that ultimate outcome is not yet there, so we might as well fight it while we can. Knowing full well that it's not going to end well, you know, which in some way goes back to that strawberry thing.
I was going to say that. Right? That's right. They had a few strawberries along the way.
Exactly.
They? Yeah. And we all die.
There's a
and it's never nice. We just got to get some strawberries.
There's a Sitting Bull quote that's Sitting Bull was the other major Lakota leader of the Stai. He has an awesome quote that's exactly like that. He says, you know, the whites may get me at last, but I'll have good times until then. And I was like, okay, well, that's a way to...
It's true for all of us. The right? whites are going to get us all, I swear to God. I'm just trying to have a good time while I'm here until they get me. So he becomes a real problem for the United States.
Yeah.
And he takes some... He scores some points, doesn't he?
Yeah, he has... actually, there's a moment where the U.S., they start this war in the 1860s. War is not going well because the U.S. is in the middle of the Civil War, so they can only commit so many. They thought they can beat them with limited resources, or now they can't, mainly because these guys are nomadic. So you can't, you know, you don't have a city that you can go take. You can never find them. The only time when you see them is when they shoot you and then they are gone. You know, it's classic guerrilla-style warfare, so it's very hard to beat these guys. And the U.S. is losing money and lives trying to chase these guys all over the place. It's not working well. There are a few battles. There's one where in Wyoming, Lakota show up outside of a fort. They keep harassing soldiers every time they go out for days in a row until finally, like, maybe 100 soldiers chase them. And this group of Lakota play this dangerous game of making it look like they are running for their lives, but really kind of holding their horse back because they don't want these guys to give up the chase. And they lead them over a couple of miles, over a hill into the next valley where there's 1,000 Lakota and Cheyenne waiting for them, or kill them all, you know. So long story short, the U.S. government is saying, okay, this thing is not working. We're losing money, we're losing lives, this thing sucks. How about we sign a peace treaty? 1868, Fort Laramie Treaty, they sit down, they say, whatever you want, we'll give it to you.
You want, we'll give you all of Western South Dakota. That's your nation. That's the boundary of your nation. Not only that, but for any land that you own to be legally sold to either the US or private citizens, 75% of your entire tribe has to sign. Meaning we can't just grab some drunk guy, say, hey, your leader signed. Sorry, guys, it's done. No, we have to get 75% of the whole tribes. It's solid. The problem is, like we told with every other treaty, the Fort Laramie suffers from the same problem, which is nobody, when they are writing, nobody means to keep it. You know, it will be broken like every other treaty gets broken, which kind of tells you that the purpose of signing treaties wasn't, you are buying time. You know, you're essentially, this war is not going well. We'll give you what you want. You guys relax. We don't have to worry about you for a while. When we have the resources to break the treaty and start again, we'll do it. But until then, we stop hemorrhaging lives and money in a war that's not going well. So there's a time from like 1868 to 1874 where they are more or less at peace, kind of. Then there will be an expedition going to the Black Hills of South Dakota, discovering gold in the Black Hills. So at that point, the U.S. government is like, we would like to buy the Black Hills from you. Dakota's like, yeah, fuck you. No, we're not selling. That's not going to happen. And that's where they say, oh, fuck, okay, I guess this Fort Laramie Treaty, forget it. And they stop even trying to make it look like they are just going to be like, screw it. We're just going to ignore the treaty, pretend it's not there. And so there's one more big round of warfare between the tribes and U.S. U.S. still got their ass kicked in this famous battle at the Little Big Horn in Montana, one of them, which is kind of iconic because it happened almost to the day, like within a couple of weeks of the 100-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. So you have U.S. feeling, you know, people patting themselves on the back. Look at what a big, powerful nation we have become over a 100-year period. And then news come out that a group of people who are considered Stone Age savages just crashed the U.S. Army, pisses a lot of people off. So they're going to put more resources into going after these guys. Battle of the Little Big Horn is their swan song. You know, it's done. They won the battle, they lose the war. Because now the army will be on their tail all the time. The bison are disappearing. You know, there were like some 40 million buffaloes in the United States at the beginning of the century. By 1895, there will be less than 1,000. So it's a near wipeout, and it's almost happened by 1877, 1876. So one after another, all the different tribes surrender. Sitting Bull takes his guys into Canada to try to stay there for a little bit. He's just going to be able to buy himself maybe 4 more years there. Crazy Horse is kind of the last one to surrender, and he's not well suited for peace. He's not a diplomat. He's not a sweet talker. He doesn't know how to play the game. Other Lakota leaders who have been playing the game before, they don't like him too much because he makes them look bad. You know, these guys have been making compromises day in and day out in committees and counter committees, arguing with the U.S. government, figuring out how much of their way of life they are going to trade on a daily basis. And here come the guy who everybody look as, oh, look at the image of the uncorrupted, tough guy who didn't give in. Makes them look bad. So they start spreading rumors about him. The U.S. government is more than happy to believe any rumor about him because they know that this war has been going on for like 20 years, basically on and off. If he's going to start again, it's because he's going to run off and start things up. So they basically set him up to be killed. They tell him they are going to have a meeting. They're not having a meeting. They are trying to arrest him. When he realizes they are trying to put him in a cage, he pulls out his knife, starts fighting. And that kind of goes back to this vision that he had when he was young. The story is that during his vision, he was shown that he would be undefeatable in battle, but he could get killed when his own people are holding him back. And in this case, there's a guy who's Lakota police. He has been hired by the government to enforce government policies on the reservation, trying to take the knife from him. And while they're struggling from the knife, a U.S. soldier comes up, stick a bayonet through Crazy Horse and kills him. So that's the tale of, like, he died within weeks of surrendering.
In 1876? Seven. Which is a very important date, right? Mm-hmm. So from 1861 to 1865, most of the U.S. Army is fighting the Civil War. And then from 1865 to 1876, most of the U.S. Army is occupying the South, mm-hmm, in Reconstruction. So the Indians had a little window there, a little chance to get away because the army was so occupied down south for so long. After that, though, game was on, and it was pretty much just a matter of time, right? Yeah. They just chased them to the ocean, essentially, and killed them or destroyed them or put them somewhere to change them, right?
Definitely.
So the Lakota and a lot of the tribes at that time end up in the Indian reform schools.
Yeah, that's what's going to happen. Like, if the wars end there... And there's a little tail end later, because about 13 years later, by 1890, there will be this religious movement that kind of give hope to the tribes, will be squashed in blood in a big massacre. But, you know, basically the wars are over. You know, the physical warfare is done. What begins is a phase of more cultural warfare, of just U.S. effort to try to... I guess it's the difference between the vicious racist and the nice racist, quote-unquote. You know, the vicious racist is, I hate you because you have a certain skin color, go die. The nice racist, which is what the U.S. government will use at this time, is, we don't hate you because of your skin color. We hate you because of your stupid culture. So if we could go rid of all of your stupid culture and we turn you, you know, short of taking the Michael Jackson pill that makes you white overnight, you do everything conceivably possible to become like us, then we're good. Then we can deal with you. Even that's not really true, because there is some more overt, but that's the theory.
It's actually anti-racist, right?
Right.
But it is also anti-Indian.
Totally.
Right.
It's, we'll squeeze the Indianness out of... There was the slogan of the boarding... Because what happens is, you know, they start putting Indian kids in school because they realize the adults, they're too set in their ways. They're not going to change. Kids, they are more malleable. Put the Indian kids in school, but they spend a few hours in school, then they go home, they still speak the language, they still pick up the culture, it's not working well. So we're going to put the Indian kids instead to boarding school, located far away from the reservation where they are, you know, full control under the teacher, they don't see their family most of the year, that's a little easier to completely change their culture. And that's where that shift will happen. That will be the one of the slogans of the boarding schools was to kill the Indian to save the man. You know, we'll squeeze the Indianness out of you so that we can save you as a human being. And that's actually, let's see.
You have some before and after pictures.
Yeah, the before and after pictures are really trippy. So these are like some of the postcards that the boarding schools would send to show the good work they are doing, the before and after. So this is what this lady looks like when she arrives.
You can describe it for the people who can't see.
Of course, yeah, because we are, you know, the podcast version, yeah. So here you have this lady in buckskin clothing, hair down below her hips, native, there's no mistaking her for any other ethnicity. It's pretty clear where she's at. And you see the after picture where she's looks like she's getting married. She's in this bridal gown, white, all her hair is perfectly neat and kept together. Every scene scream savagery / civilized, according to the way these guys would view it.
And there's her husband is dressed in a suit.
Yeah, and he looks miserable.
Yeah, well, that's what suits do. They make you miserable. That's the point of them. But also, what is the point of the American business suit? What was it? It was invented in the 1840s and 1850s for white people to make everyone look the same. Mm. It's because for business and government, right, these are teams. It has to be a team. It has to be organized. And it's very difficult to manage if everyone looks different. So it's much easier to manage if everyone is wearing a uniform. You know that if you've ever run a business or been a part of a business, right? So the business suit was explicitly designed to make everyone alike, originally just for white people. But then once they started to assimilate others, the business suit was the first thing the men had to wear. Right? So there you have an Indian right there in a business suit. So here's another before and after.
Yeah, and this one too gives you to what you're speaking of. You see, you clearly recognize native clothing in the before, but native clothing varies. You know, the colors are different, the exact attire is different from one kid to the next. One is wearing feathers, one is not. One is wearing long necklaces, one is not. One is, you know, there's clearly some similarity from the culture, but there's also a lot of individual variation. The after picture, they are all wearing the exact same suit, buttoned up the exact same way, all these three boys in this picture. I think they are brothers. And they, you know, this is, you have gone through the machine and this is what it spits out on the other end, where your hair is perfectly neat and combed. It kind of kills the individuality here and is about churning out. And this idea of killing the individuality is really interesting too, not only in terms of how you look, but even names. it's funny how they change, because Indian names traditionally, the way it was when you are born, you get some kind of baby name. Doesn't mean anything. It's like you're just born. Nothing has happened to you. So you are chubby or curly hair or whatever, you know, some random cutesy child name, because it's nothing to tell about you. At some point as you grow up, something meaningful happens. And there will be a story that's attached to that name. And so you pick up a name that embodies either certain qualities that they wish you to remember, or there's usually, and throughout your life, if something significant enough happens, you may retire your previous name and pick up a new one. Like, for example, there's a story of this one guy who, I forget what his previous name was, but he was an adult already. He signed a peace treaty with the United States, and he says that from that day forward, he's going to let his fighting knife go dull, meaning his war days are over. And so, celebrate the occasion, he'll become a dull knife. That will become his name, right? So names were very individualized. They were very tied to a particular story attached to something that happened to you. When you go to the boarding schools, all that needs to go. Whatever your father's personal name was, that just became your last name. So your father was Dull Knife because he signed the treaty, whatever. Your last name is now Dull Knife. Mm-hmm. And we'll pick some Anglo name for you as a first name. You are Joe Dull Knife or Mary Dull Knife or whatever the hell, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like how you, in one sense, you have a culture that's very heavy on this individual, to the point that you're not even going to have one name in your life. It changes as you change in life, to a culture in which that's completely gone. Your name is going to be the same throughout the rest of your life, and even the concept of a last name that really didn't exist is created in this fashion.
Yeah. So I wanted to amplify something you said a while ago, because it's so important and it's something I actually know about, which is the debate that was going on among whites and within the government during this time, which was between those, and Daniele referenced this, but I just want to talk about it more, those who wanted to eliminate them, to kill them, to wipe them out. And that was mostly the settlers. That was actually mostly non-government entities, as far as I understand it, who were the ones who were interested in annihilating the Indians, killing them, wiping them out, because they wanted that land and they wanted to take it. By the 1860s and 70s, a new movement had emerged, driven by missionaries originally, but eventually it took hold in the federal government and became the policy in the 1870s and 80s, which was what Daniele's been talking about, which was to assimilate them. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge fight going on among white people between essentially the racists, right, who believed that they could never be reformed and therefore they had to be killed, and those who believed that they not only could but should be reformed, who are the anti-racists. But now make yourself a Lakota Indian in Montana during that period, and which would you rather deal with? Would you rather fight it to the death,
right,
or would you rather end up looking like that wearing a business suit? I mean, I don't know, but isn't that interesting, though, that the anti-racists were the ones who wiped out Indian culture, that deliberately, mm-hmm. that was part of it. Anti-racism has always been this, in this country anyway. It's always come with a very vicious dark side to it. You must eliminate all of your culture that's distinctive from ours, right? That's the thing about anti-racism that's never been discussed. So now I want to ask you the big question. Okay, so what you've been describing is what's been called how the West was won.
Right, of course.
So until about the 1970s, that's how the textbooks described what you've been describing,
mm-hmm.
how the West was won. It was a victory. It was the establishment of civilization. We are sitting right now in Los Angeles, surrounded by buildings and cars and freeways and air conditioning and microphones and podcasting equipment. That could not be possible, I don't think, maybe, had the West not been won in mm-hmm. those ways, had we not eliminated the existence of Indians who were probably sitting on this very piece of land that you and I are sitting on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Was the conquest of this land, the elimination of those cultures, the destruction of human bodies who were different, who refused to become a part of modern civilization, was that a tragedy or a victory? Because until the 1970s, it was a victory. Since the 1970s, it's been a tragedy, right? We think of this as a tragedy, as a terrible thing we did while we're sitting in our air conditioning. Okay? And I honestly don't know. I don't have, this is something I just don't know.
Sure.
I like air conditioning a lot, But I also feel very bad about what they did to those poor people. What do you think?
Well, and I think it's one of the things that it really depends on who you ask and when you ask it. Because when you ask it within living memory of people, it's like, yeah, I'm glad you have your cell phone that cost my grandma and everyone else she knew their lives. Screw you. 2,000 years later, when there's nobody who has a living connection with something, you can go back and say, hey, that wasn't, you know, yeah, it sucked, but it served a greater purposes for where I'm at right now. It's always through somebody's viewpoint. And depending on how attached you are to certain things and what connection you are to the ones who actually had to pay a price for it, usually the answer tend to change. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the things where when it comes to lifestyle, okay, forget the personal aspect, forget the individual suffering. What is better in the great scheme of things for humanity? Is the idea of progress as we think of it a good one, a bad one? I don't have a particular feeling either way, in the sense that I don't over-romanticize the past thinking, yes, we should all go back to living how it was 10,000 years ago. There are some cool things. There are also some awful things. There are some awesome things to live in now, and yet half of the country is on antidepressants. It's kind of like, you know, it's a complicated thing to say because is not that clear cut. And ultimately, it doesn't matter because it's not like you can turn back the clock. It's not like you have a choice.
Well, wait a minute. Yes, we can. And some people have. Some people have gone back to the land.
In which way?
Some people have gone native. Well, like the hippies in the 1960s and 70s tried to live explicitly like natives.
Yeah.
And they did a pretty decent job of it in many cases, right? So, but also there's now many movements to do that, essentially to move back toward the, you know, the existence of natives.
Well, and I think that's where the discussion becomes interesting is, because realistically you're not going to, you know, just in terms of available resources around you, how clean the water is or the air, a bunch of things, you cannot fully turn back the clock. You can turn back the clock in a partial way, in your own four walls kind of way.
Pol Pot did a pretty good job in Cambodia.
Right.
I mean, I'm serious. It can be done, right? And it can be done in small scale, like as I was describing the hippie commune, or it can be done on a large scale with a state destroying everything.
And I think that's where the discussion becomes interesting is what is ideal world. You can create your own civilization. You can create your own world. You can create your own lifestyle. What would you want to keep of what we have today, the many cool things that exist today, while getting rid of the less pleasant aspect? And of course, this, by the way, it's an individual decision, right? No two people are going to give the same answer. But like, there are certain things that we have today that are amazing, that I would not want to give up. There are other things on the other end that I think we would be wise to borrow ideas from other culture, other time places, and figure out how we can fit them here. Because the goal ultimately is, how do you create the best of both worlds? How do you not get stuck with one thing and all of its limitations? Or you get the other one that has some cool things and 10,000 limitations. How can we find, you know, have a almost mixed martial art approach to creating life on Earth, of like, how do we take the best from different things and combine it in a way that give human beings the greatest amount of happiness?
I love that. Now I need to talk about football, though, because today is Super Bowl Sunday. You're an Italian, so you don't know about this, you know, this sport, right? But it's a national holiday for us. The game begins in, I think, 3 hours, so we need to pivot to football very quickly. Okay,
football.
You've been here for a while, so you may know this is fairly important to us, this game, right? So let's talk about football for a second.
Yes.
So you get the ball maybe on the 20-yard line, okay? That's where you start. And then what are you supposed to do then? How do you win?
Land grab.
Yeah.
You move forward, don't you? And you got your team. Yard by yard, inch by inch, until you hit the goal line, and then it's a touchdown. That's how you score, right? Well, think about the North American continent, the landmass, right? And you think about the 20-yard line or one end zone being the East Coast and the other end zone being the West Coast, and I think you get what I'm saying here. Isn't it interesting that at the Carlisle Indian School, they taught the Indians how to play football?
Yeah, because they were bored to death, you know, all their lives suck in every other way. The one thing that they found that was kind of fun, it was playing sports. And so the story of football in the late 1800s is kind of funny, because what happens is the wars with the tribes are over.
the frontier is over. There is no more go west, young man, and carve your own. There is no west anymore. There's like the whole thing has been conquered. There's US civilization from coast to coast. And in some way, this creates kind of a crisis of masculinity for some people in US because they have like, okay, well, if we can go out and kill Indians, if we can grab the land and slaughter a bear, how do I prove that I'm a real man? You know, how does that? And there's a real concern among the upper classes in particular that they won the game of civilization. They have all the comforts of civilization. Their kids go to the best schools. They have all the privileges. And that's great. But, oh, fuck, now our kids are growing up soft. They don't have those experiences that make you a real man. So, winning may not work out so well for us. Enters the game of football. Okay, you don't go scalp people, you don't kill bears, but maybe if you go in on a tough, brawly game where you can just bash each other's skull with some other guys, you can still prove that. And football back then had minimal protection, ridiculous degree of allowed brutality in the game. Like, you could do fairly regularly people died in football. Well, not super regularly, but at least on a yearly basis, somebody died in a football game. Major injuries were common. And he was like, okay, that's the way how you prove you're a man. So oddly enough, the places that were the big football spots were all the Ivy League places. You know, the higher up in society, the more you had something to prove that you are still a real man, that you hadn't become soft because of civilization. So Yale, Harvard, Stanford, all of were the places that were the football powerhouses. Them and Carlisle Indian School. And so it was kind of funny because you had kids of presidents, senators, Supreme Court justices, the richest, most privileged people in US, and literally the poorest people in the whole country competing in the same game at a high level. And the funny thing about Carlisle is that what they would do is that, I mean, these guys were physically, they were usually a bit smaller and much more poorly nourished than their opponents. So they had to figure out ways to be competitive. And the way they would figure out ways is they would look at the rule book. They would see what is that's not explicitly prohibited here, but that maybe we can still get away doing. So, you know, example, one day during an important snap, the players for Carlisle, somebody snapped the ball, the guy who gets it hide the ball underneath his shirt, and all the players are making it look like they have the ball hidden underneath their shirt. And it's not illegal technically at the time, so the defense can figure out which one has the ball. They all run and score the touchdown, pull out the ball. It was me, I scored. And so, of course, after that, at the end of the year, the association goes, okay, let's make that illegal. And Carlisle is like, okay, what else can we do that nobody does, you know? And the game of football, the rules of the game of football are basically developed early on as a way to stop Carlisle for being competitive. He's like,
to which I say, go Redskins.
Right. And so it's a funny story because it's like the quintessential American game is born at a time where these are literally the kids of the people who kill themselves in battle, kill each other in battle 20 years before, are now beating each other up on the football game. And the rules of the game are, to a large degree, based on these encounters.
You know who loved football, Daniele?
Do tell.
Teddy Roosevelt.
Yes.
You know who else loved football, Daniele?
Oh.
Franklin Roosevelt. You know who else loved football, Daniele? Everybody who established American foreign policy in the 20th century.
Of course.
Because it wasn't just at Harvard and Yale and Stanford. It was also at the white people's boarding schools like Groton Academy, mm-hmm. where all the political establishment and Franklin Roosevelt and all those guys were trained. They loved them some football. There's pictures of all those guys looking just like these Indians in football uniforms, marching across the field, marching mm-hmm. across North America, and then marching to the Philippines and beyond.
Of course.
But go Redskins, man.
By the
cheating.
Way, on that
to find a way to win, I like it. Yes,
on the philosophical aspect of the games, it's funny because even though Carlisle, the Indian kids at Carlisle did great in football, usually when you look at native communities today, football is not that big of a game. They don't like it as much. They are big on again, there are exceptions, but typically the big game
fans of the Redskins, I've heard though.
Yeah, always.
Honestly,
but the big one is basketball. Okay. And in many ways, they tie it to, they say, well, because in basketball, every person is moving. There's a constant movement that's not just in a straight line. Mm-hmm. And it's more like playing Indian Warfare, where it was like you dart in, you dart out. There's rather than this slow, grinding march forward that's more like an army in a traditional way.
Everyone knows, I think, the world, and especially Americans, is overworked. And today, it can be very hard to find the time to sit down and learn more about the world. It's not easy when the likes of social media can be so addictive and time-consuming also. So you may think you don't have the time to read a whole book or to develop yourself. In fact, I often don't read a whole book. I usually just use it for my work. There's an app I highly recommend. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is the only app that takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, the kind I use, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes so you can read or listen to them easily. Blinkist is made of people like you and me, very busy people with active work schedules, who want to get the main points of the books very quickly without reading the entire book. With an audio feature, Blinkist makes it so easy to finish 4 books a day while you're on the go. 8 million people right now are using Blinkist, and it has a massive and growing library, from self-help to business to health to even history books. I like Blinkist personally because, as I said, for my own work, I use books rather than read them entirely. So in less than 15 minutes, I feel like I can get from a book exactly what I need. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for the unregistered audience. Go to Blinkist.com/renegade to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/renegade to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/renegade. This brings us to another different person, but who is very similar to these people in a lot of ways, who you've devoted several episodes of your podcast to, one of absolutely the greatest renegade heroes in American history, one of my greatest heroes. I might mention him in Renegade, but I don't enough. You are an expert on this guy. His name's Jack Johnson. Do you have any pictures of Jack Johnson? Jack Johnson was the heavyweight champion of the world, boxer. And you guys know who this is generally, right? There was a special done on him by Ken Burns, which probably wasn't that good.
Wasn't bad.
It was okay. Good, not as good as what you do. But let's talk about Jack Johnson for a second here. I'm sure a lot of people don't know the full story here. There's probably no greater badass in American history.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those characters that just, like, you would think he's made up. Because he's like, there's no way that this guy is the real thing.
And he's operating at the same time as these Indian reform schools. Turn of the century, that's when he is. He comes from the South.
Right.
He was born in the late 19th century, I think.
Yeah, I'm in Texas. Yep. And let me try to see if I can dig up a Jack Johnson picture. Because he's just so fun. He's one of those guys that, oh man, why do I not have Jack Johnson? Okay, oh yes, here you go. There he is. So here we see him. Basically, it's his life in a nutshell. Knocking out white guys in the ring and sleeping with white women. Here we have a picture of one of his white wives, because there were more than one over time. Not at the same time, though. And here is...
this is what year again, roughly?
He was built up in the last decade of the 1800s as a boxer. Then he became a champion in the first decade of the 1900s. I think it was 1910 when he won the title. Then a big, huge match in 1912. And he remains champion for a few years after that.
Let's put this in context. Okay, so during the 1890s, that decade alone, roughly 5 to 6 black men per week were lynched.
Yeah.
So this is the height of racist Jim Crow right then. This guy is, as Daniel, I just said, knocking out white guys in the ring and then having sex with white women. And the worst part was that he flaunted it.
Yeah, exactly. Not hiding it.
Proud of it.
Exactly, yeah.
So he was not super popular with everybody, let's just say.
You can say that. There's the quintessential Jack Johnson story that usually is the first one that gets to be told because he captures very quickly the vibe of the guy. There's a story that after he started making his money with boxing, he was really into cars. You know, they were the first cars were becoming popular. He really loved to drive his cars fast. And so he gets stopped somewhere in the South and the cop walks up to him and he's like, "Hey, boy, you are speeding. I'm going to have to fine you." And back then you could pay your ticket on the spot in cash to the cop, which leaves a
which few, I'm sure went directly to the city coffers. Yes,
how it always works, right? And so the cop is like, "Okay, this is gonna cost you $50. And Johnson is like, pull out his cash, hands him $100. And the cop is like, I don't have change for that kind of money. And Johnson is like, no. 2 hours from now, I'm going to be driving the same way and I'm going to be doing the same speed. So I'm just paying you ahead because I don't want to, you know. That's Jack Johnson for you, right? He's like this, fuck you, you cannot touch me, I'm above you all. There's his whole thing, which is insane when you think about when he was alive, is his idea was, I'm going to live like racism doesn't exist. And he's like, what do you mean as if racism? You're in 1910 United States, people are getting lynched on the time during a famous fight that he had in Reno, Nevada. The band was playing a song right before he came onto the ring called All Coons Look Alike to Me. He was like, you know, he would walk into stadiums where it would be like 10,000 people screaming for his death, right? And this approach was big smiles and racism. What racism? What are we talking? Is there racism out here? I haven't noticed. I'm sure is. And, you know, it's... Of course, I'm sure it comes at a psychological cost because it's a badass attitude to keep, you know, one end, to pretend that what's obvious under your eyes, you're reminded of this shit every second of your life, every moment. You act like it doesn't even touch you, which in some way, it can work, right? The least you pay attention to something, sometimes it psychologically it helps not to dwell on shit. But then there's also the reality that you're gonna, you know, it's right here in your face. Of course, you're gonna be reminded of it sometime, and it does... You know, this constant denial of it and being above it. Well, it's going to work some of the times, not all of the times.
But they did get him.
Yeah, of course.
The Mann Act.
Yeah, what happens with Johnson is that when he won, black people were not allowed to fight for the heavyweight title because the idea was that the heavyweight champion of the world was the ultimate symbol of the man, the toughest man in the world. So... The boxing heavyweight champion was the pinnacle of masculinity. And the idea was a black man, we cannot have a black man beating a white guy. We're not letting it. So champion after champion, Johnson rose through the ranks, was obviously the number one challenger, and nobody would give him a fight because he was like, nope, sorry, you're a black guy, we don't do it. Eventually, a guy became a heavyweight champion, apparently needed the money bad enough that after fighting a few other white guys for moderate paychecks, he was able to put some crazy money, say, I won't do the fighting. I will fight Jack Johnson. So everybody goes like, what? He's willing to? If you pay me $30,000, which back then nobody had ever paid for a boxing match, right? Well, he find a boxing promoter that puts the money down. So he's like, well, shit, I guess I'm fighting Jack Johnson. You know, he's like... And so Johnson wins, and now it's too late. Now he's the heavyweight champion of the world. How do we get the title away from him? That's where the whole thing of the great white hope, term that I'm sure you have heard before, comes into play. It's like any big white guy who can vaguely swing his fist, let's throw him at Jack Johnson, hoping that he lands a big punch, knock him out, and the white race is redeemed. And doesn't work. You know, Johnson is too good, and he beats guy after guy after guy. Couple of years into it, they drag back the old champion, whether retired, undefeated, was badass, burly guy, was this even bigger than Jack Johnson. Because one of the critiques is like, the guy you beat for the title was a very small heavyweight. You're a bigger, stronger guy. So this dude is massive. There's this letter writing campaign. This hurts because I actually like Jack London as a writer, but he was racist like most people back then. So he started his letter writing campaign inviting Jim Jeffrey, the former champion, to the honor of the white race is in your hands, only you can redeem it and stuff, which again, he spoils it because I love Jack London so much, some of his writing, but he was a vicious racist. There's no argument about it. And, you know, so enough popular pressure builds up that Jim Jeffries is like, fuck it, I'll do it. I'm going and we're biggest fight ever in boxing history, right? They meet, they are supposed to do it in California. There's enough pressure from church groups to say, nope, can't do. The governor changes his mind. They have to, at the last minute, set it up in Reno, Nevada, where nobody gives a fuck about anything, so everything is legal. So they set up the thing in Reno, and this is before even radio was around, right? And yet the whole country is glued to something. Like they are in the street where somebody by telegraph is going to give the news and shout them out and everybody find the blow account. They have a bunch of places around the country. They have a white boxer and a black boxer hired to stand there. And every time the guy with the telegraph tells them, Johnson landed a left hook to the body, then they act it out on stage for a... It's like, it's so weird to think that this was like little over 100 years ago, because it's like prehistory in so many ways. But it's before internet, before TV, before radio, before right, just about anything. And yet, the moment Jack Johnson is able to demolish Jeffries, and the way he went about it, speaking to what you were saying about not being exactly flaunting it, you know, there were times when he would almost drop opponents and pick them up before they fall, because he was like, no, we're not done here, you know. It's like, all the shit you guys put me through, no, you don't get out so easy. This is not gonna...
And where's your wife, by the way?
Right, exactly. That's usually how. And you know, and throughout the entire time he would talk shit with the corner, from, because they would yell all sort of racist insult at him to try to get him riled up, and he would talk shit to them, and it's fairly hilarious, the whole thing. And when he finally knock out Jim Jeffries, riots break out in like 50 different places, 25 states in US, 50 different cities. Bunch of people die. Exact number varies, some from a dozen to 30 to significant numbers, you know, solid numbers of people die because either black people celebrating getting murdered by white crowds, or there were a couple of cases of black guys shooting into a white crowds. But either way, bunch of people. Talk about it. This is a sporting event, right? And it's not just a sporting event. It's one of the most dramatic moments in modern U.S. history when it comes to race relations, when it comes to so many other things. And because at that point it became clear, okay, we're not going to get the title back from Jack Johnson anytime soon. There is no white guy out there on earth today who can beat him. What do we do? That's when then legal prosecution became intensified, and they tried to bust him on, he was really fond of women in general, sex workers in particular, and he had bunch of relationships with also became primarily white women later in life. And one of these ladies, the lady's mom, along with a prosecutor, find a way to accuse him, Johnson, of having kidnapped her. She say, he hasn't kidnapped him. I love him. He's cool. I like to be around him. Nah, she's crazy. Throw her in insane asylum for a while. And they try to build a case on kidnapping charges. And the problem is there's no evidence. There's nothing. And so they're like, fuck. Wait, Mann Act. Mann Act passed in 1910 was this piece of legislation that on the surface it sounded really noble, because it was against... forced prostitution, you know, enslaving poor white women, taking them from one state, selling them into prostitution in another state. Yeah, that's fucked up. Okay, forced prostitution, not a good thing. I can see why. It's based on a lot of paranoia, because it's based on this notion that there are these gangs, primarily seen as Jewish gangs, that are operating prostitution rings, kidnapping white women. Now, I'm sure stuff like that happened once in a blue moon. Not nearly as common as it was advertised. But, you know, it's like, okay, sure, you can put a law that's addressing something that mostly doesn't exist, but whatever, that's fine. The crime is a bad crime, so okay. The problem is that the meaning got changed. So the Mann Act was written in a way that said that it was for immoral purposes, taking one woman from a state to another. And again, the meaning was immoral purposes was selling her into prostitution into another state. But hey, what else is immoral according to the standards of the 1910s? Is sex outside of marriage is immoral. So first it becomes prostitution in general, willing or unwilling. So if you take a prostitute across state lines, boom, Mann Act violation, even if she's willing. Then it becomes anybody who's not married, crossing state lines, having even the remote plan for sex, it's a violation of the Mann Act. So suddenly is... any boyfriend, girlfriend crossing state lines, they are violating federal law. Now, clearly you cannot enforce that law on everybody because you have to prosecute half of the country. So what they will do is start enforcing it selectively. It's like, is there somebody we don't like for a particular reason and we want to get rid of them, but we can't catch them on anything else? maybe we can use the Mann Act. So guys like Charlie Chaplin, for example, you know, he was a big time communist. So it's like, okay, he's communist, fuck that guy. Well, we can't charge him because he's communist alone. You need to have done something. Well, he's not breaking any laws. Hey, he traveled across state lines with somebody who wasn't his wife. Mann Act violation. Great. And of course, Jack Johnson. He was being so public about traveling with this harem of women around him all the time across state lines that made it possible to charge him on a Mann Act thing. He was convicted, escaped, ran off and lived as the heavyweight champion in Europe for the most part, defending his title while on the run. And he does that for almost a decade. And then eventually he's getting tired. His mom is dying, all this shit. He's like, I'm done being on the run all the time. So he does come back into the United States, will do 1 year in jail. And then he actually managed to have a fairly long life after that and after he has lost the title and stuff.
So I was in an In-N-Out Burger last night, and on the counter, there was a big can with a picture on it. It said, human trafficking, look for the signs. And it had pictures of people of various colors, women, men, all kinds of ethnicities, sort of just standing there lined up. And we were supposed to assume that, I guess, one of these people in this picture is being human trafficked. And In-N-Out was covered in these posters, and it was paid for by some organization I've never heard of, promising to end slavery. Now, human trafficking, as everybody knows, is a thing that's all around the society. Apparently, we are surrounded by people who are either being trafficked or who are traffickers. The origin, the very origin of that is what was called, or is called now, the white slavery. Mm-hmm. We call it now hysteria, which is exactly what Daniela has been describing. Beginning with Jack Johnson, there began this hysteria that Jewish men and Chinese men and black men were kidnapping white women and forcing them to be prostitutes. When in fact, it was basically, there was just a lot of immigration going on and a lot of prostitution going on, right? But they used this, all this as a pretext to crush Jack Johnson, mm-hmm. to crush interracial relationships and to crush immigrants and to crush ultimately sex workers. So the Mann Act is still essentially on the books. It's the origin, it's the root of this human trafficking hysteria, which is, as we're speaking, probably putting a woman in jail as right now. Right now, there's probably a cop in this country who's putting a woman or a man in jail for violation of essentially the Mann Act. That's the origins of all that stuff. So we've come full circle here.
Which is kind of even the law, what is it called? SESTA, the one that was passed.
SESTA FOSTA, yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah, yes. It's very much, it's like the high-tech internet version of the Mann Act.
Precisely.
In a lot of ways. And again, when you look at the theories, like, yeah, sex trafficking sucks. That's awful. I can see, yeah, you need to have a law against it, except that it never gets to be applied to what it's theoretically applied to. It gets to be applied to a bunch of things that have nothing to do with it. It's kind of like in some way, that's the problem with language sometimes and how it's used. You know, if you tell me during the Cold War, communism sucks, there's a problem with it, it's good to stop it, I can see the logic how communism sucks. You know, there's a lot of bad things that have happened in lots of communism. It's like, okay, I get it. The problem is that when suddenly the definition becomes anybody who doesn't embrace an ultra-right-wing version of American politics is a communist, it's like, whoa, you took something that realistically in the US, the number of communists was about this big, and now you're applying it to more than half of the country. That's a problem. That becomes the problem. It's like, you know, you take a law against sex trafficking. Okay, we're good. Small phenomenon, but fucked up. So yes, there's a problem. But now we apply to sex work, or in the case of the Mann Act, even not sex work at all, even just sex outside of marriage. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You took something that the theory sounded maybe exaggerated, a little paranoid, but not bad. And now you applied it to something that has nothing to do with the original intent, and you completely fuck it up.
So I did a pretty deep dive into researching the white slavery panic, mm-hmm. of the early 20th century. And I think I did my due diligence. I found one case that might have been actual kidnapping and enslavement of a woman.
Right.
One. I mean, again, who knows? But in terms of actual evidence, that's all there is. And it's very vague. But historians across the board agree that this was almost entirely hysteria. Mm-hmm. And you referenced communism. So 60, 50 years later, we had another hysteria, right? Now, there were communists, and they did, sure. in fact, work for Joseph Stalin, and they were, in fact, trying to subvert the United States, but there were only a tiny handful of them. But we acted and mm-hmm. behaved as if they were half the country, as you just said. And that is the definition of hysteria. And we're right now in the midst of other hysterias, aren't we, that look kind of similar, right? We kind of think now maybe another country is controlling us and other people are controlling us and other groups from outside are controlling us. Daniele, thank you so much for all those presentations and for introducing us to these incredible characters in American history who I, Mr. Renegade Historian, have oddly neglected. And I'm so glad that you're filling in those gaps. Now is the chance for everyone to talk to us or ask us questions or yell at us or anything you want to do. So if you guys want to take your time, collect yourselves and think about it, you can, or we can just give you the mic right now. But I'm going to put a chair right there and you're going to get one of these mics. Anybody who wants to come ask a question or say anything. But you have to come talk into the mic. And you can ask, by the way, I know, I'm pretty sure you're cool with this. You can ask us about anything. You can ask us about history, Crazy Horse, Teddy Roosevelt, or our personal lives. And we're down, right? Yep. And you know me. We're down for anything. So here's the mic. Take it if you want it. Just don't knock over that American flag, Jared.
I would never do anything to the American flag. That would be awful. I can't tell you how excited I am that you're here. And Dad doesn't know this, that I've listened to your podcast for quite some time. And specifically, the Crazy Horse episode really touched me because I had just heard about your personal history at the time. And I'm surrounded by death, not only within me, but I have worked in like foreign policy issues for quite some time. We live under an empire, so there's death just everywhere. So I'm so excited about what Dad is doing at the Renegade University and what you've done with the History on Fire podcast. And the people that came out this weekend, I came to Thad's event the last time in LA, and the Crazy Horse episode would have been a little bit before that, but I was going through a very dark time in my life, and coming out here kind of reinvigorated me, and I now live out in here, and this has been fantastic. And so I guess what I wanted to connect it to is that there's so many things about empire and Woodrow Wilson and the global liberal hegemony that we were even touching on. But I actually want to go to something else, because I believe in an interview you were talking about part of your healing process and going to sex workers. And Thad has had a long, great history with Maggie McNeil, who mm-hmm. is just wonderful. I love her dearly and we're friends. And that... So she has made the argument that the war on whores is the new war on drugs. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me, and I wanted to hear your perspective on this because of how you, it was what you had said, and I can't remember who you were doing an interview sure. with. I feel like you were talking to Thad.
I think he may have been.
Okay.
I think he was.
Okay. But you were very passionate, and it just kind of reminds me that the way I'm from like a libertarian mm-hmm. anarchist perspective of things, and you know, none of that is really relevant, except that the reason why I love Thaddeus and I love you, and I mean that, is because what I'm all about is a liberatory anti-authoritarianism that you can try to put in different boxes. Sure. That's why labels don't really fucking matter.
Yeah.
And so sex workers, if they are now the most marginalized among us in some respects, and as we were talking about the crackdowns, mm-hmm. FOSTA and SESTA, the financing that's going to be cut from all sorts of different people, from PayPal, yep. all the different processors, everything that's happening there, the way that the surveillance state is being, you know, implemented upon us, it seems like, you know, we should do everything we can as people who support these individuals. You know, sex workers are our friends and our family mm-hmm. and people that we love. And so I guess I was wondering, you know, partially your perspective of what you think about that, what we should do sure. as to advocates and friends. And also in the context of, I know that you have a soft spot, it seems, for Teddy Roosevelt. And so I wanted to fight with you a little bit about how, you know, the modern surveillance state is partially his fucking fault.
I mean, yeah. I like the guy in... I'm attracted to most people yeah. are mildly mentally deranged. That doesn't mean that I agree with him about everything. You yes, know, it's like yes.
no, no. And your series on him was very mm-hmm. nuanced. To be fair, there was something, you know.
Yeah, because I mean, the guy's he yeah. never saw a war he didn't like. Right. He's nuts in a lot of ways. So there are some problems there where you are a hardcore imperialist who want to fight anybody for any reason all the time. Yeah, I can see how there would be some issues there. I think what I like about that guy is the fact that, other than the fact that he's insane, but I like the, because he kind of, there's individualism to the extreme in there, he breaks with just about every accepted convention of anybody. You know, the people on his side, he goes against them, he goes against the opponents, he's doing kind of his own thing. In the process of that, he fucks up royally on a bunch of issues, mm-hmm. but he also does some amazing things that no
normal American president has ever done. Mm-hmm. And so it's one of the things where it's like, you ask me, is he a good guy or a bad guy? As they say, it's complicated. You know, it's like, of course he's fucked up in a bunch of ways, but there's also, unlike pretty much every other political figure I can think of at a high level in US politics, where it's like, fucked up, fucked up, fucked up, fucked up, more fucked up, more fucked up. Hey, at least this one, there's something cool about it. It doesn't mean I endorse everything about the dude, you know, but back to the whole sex work thing that you're bringing up. Yeah, I find that bizarre, because one of the things that I see that I, like, today there's luckily so much more opposition to the war on drugs than there has ever been. And again, it's still very far from translating into an actual elimination of the war on drugs, but it feels like he's inching in that direction progressively, and that's great. And that's, you know, everybody understands it's not working. It's like, how do the same arguments not apply to sex work, in the sense that all the problems created by the criminalization of sex work are not going away anytime soon. Prohibition is not solving them. If anything, they are making them worse. And on top of it, you're victimizing a bunch of people who have nothing to do with violating anybody's will. You know, again, I understand, you know, if you're talking about, and it's not that it doesn't exist. It's rare, but it doesn't exist. Of course, there's trafficking. Of course, there's forced prostitution. Of course, there are. I mean, I've seen stuff that I'm like, yeah, that's fucking shady, and I don't like it, and I hate that shit. But that's not the only kind. And if anything, probably not even the majority. And so there are the idea of criminalizing, like, a willing participant who want to trade sex for money. How is that any, like, I often tell my students when I say, like, hey, you know, let me get this straight. It's like, most jobs you guys are ever going to get are jobs that you would never do if it wasn't for somebody's paying you. And, you know, these are jobs that you're going to trade your time and energy and everything for money. Embrace your inner hooker, because really where it's at is you are doing prostitution minus the sex. And I'm not judging it. Hey, you got to pay the bills. You got to do what you need to do. But let's be real about it. It's like this moral outrage because somebody's bringing sex into it. It's like,
ugh. I just want to jump in real quick. I said that to a class once, yeah. And that was the only time I was ever brought before a dean.
Serious?
Yes, on charges of inappropriate conduct in a classroom.
Really?
Yes.
My back to you, Jared. Laugh. You have bad luck, man.
Well, but so in that context, you know, I have worked with sex workers in different contexts that mm-hmm. we shouldn't record and talk about and further. But that comment is exactly like, have you ever worked in a cubicle? I have.
Right.
Have you been happy every fucking time? Do you love every single client you work with? No. And sometimes if you can, you make decisions. Yep, never going to see that person again, whether if you're talking in sex work or sure. not. But there's a mysticism that's wrapped around it. And maybe it's the Puritanism yeah. of America that, oh, you think this can be transactional too? No, it can't. This yeah. is holy. This is godly. And you're mm-hmm. fucking with that. And also the autonomy of women. And that, what, it was only a handful of decades ago that, you know, women couldn't open up bank accounts by themselves.
Sure.
So you see this criminalization. And so it worries me that the butt of jokes, so many comedians, you know, dead hooker jokes. That's like, right. that's so fucking common. Yeah, yeah, and it's like, that's lazy as hell, first right. of all. But so it's like a cultural change that it feels like it's happening in certain ways, but then these legal apparatus that's cracking down feels like it's also still growing at the same time. Yep. So is this just like everything else? It's a constant struggle, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't see it happening when it comes to sex work. I see it when it comes to war on drugs,
yeah.
where there's a shift happening, where sure. there's more and more opposition. And I can foresee in a very optimistic mood that that may go away eventually, mm-hmm. or at least mostly. I'm not seeing any sign right now of stuff changing when it comes to sex work. I feel like it's not even part of the discussion. You know, mm-hmm. where there's a lot of discussion about elimination of the war on drugs, I don't see much of public discussion going on regarding legalization of sex work.
Yeah.
I just don't see it.
And even amongst different ideologies too. So, you know, there's a hard push on the left against sex work. You know,
sure.
this is the capitalist system that, yep. that is enslaving you. And then even libertarians, of which, you know, the crowd I run, even though some of our, you know, founding members of people, like not the party, but sure. like I, you know, ideologies and individuals, they were sex workers. They mm-hmm. were radical, and they tried to cover that or not address it or act as if it's not important. Yep. And it seems like it actually is fundamental in so many different ways.
Yeah, that one is across the political spectrum, right? Because there's an obvious right wing against sex work. There's an obvious left wing. It's not, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't fit in a neat these guys versus those guys. It tends to be across the board a lot yeah. where. There's that's why you don't see it show up in the public discourse that much, because there are not that many people who see it as an issue, A, where their attention, B, where they have an opinion other than the existing consensus mm. as it is.
And this goes to something that Thad's always talking about, the mind-body kind of the pushback of one and the other. And it seems... that perhaps if we can start to personalize this, the politics of like self-interest mm-hmm. and, you know, explain to people right now, it's a hooker that you think, you know, you don't care about. Mm-hmm. Okay. Next, it's going to be this person. Or do you remember your uncle who was locked up for some right. joints? And now we laugh about how, you know, good life, or, hey, he was white, so he got away with it. He didn't get shot by the sure. pigs. So it seems like with a lot of these issues, it is a politics of personalization that yep. if you don't see it and you're not a part of it, it won't affect you, and you can't try to galvanize hope. So I ask you too, Thad, what can be done? Is this
what can be done? Yeah, it's this. As I've said many times, it's exactly what we're doing. It's speaking, it's saying ideas that are unspoken, that are not allowed, right? Saying what you're not supposed to say, right? Isn't that my tagline, I think? So yeah, no, really, I mean, that's what Crazy Horse did, that's what Jack Johnson did, essentially. Right, that's, they were just saying things or doing things they weren't allowed to do. Jack Johnson certainly did it almost every single day, and by doing so, he sort of made something that was completely taboo, interracial relationships, a thing. That, you know, did it stop when did the Mann Act stop interracial relationships? I don't think so. Right, he served as a model for, I think, many generations of black men. As a matter of fact, I think you talk to a lot of black men, they'll know Jack Johnson and they'll see him as a model of what masculinity is for them. Right, in many ways. And a model of how to be in the world. And also, it is very much, I think, a perfect example of someone who in no way, shape, or form merges his identity with the nation or the state or the broader community of America and remained purely an individual. And I'm not even sure he identified that much as black.
No, that's what's fascinating about it, that he was like one of, I forgot to mention that, and I'm glad you brought it up. One of the things that was awesome about him is that he was turning to the Booker T. Washington kind of black America. And he was like,
Hotep.
You know, yeah,
been talking about the Hoteps.
Yeah, I'm not...
Shout out to Hotep Jesus right now. I know you're listening. Jack Johnson's your boy, right? Keep going, Daniele.
I'm not the black guy that white people want me to be, but I'm not your black guy either, motherfucker. I'm not the... Exactly. Right. I'm me. I want to do what I want to do. I'm not going to be your role model for the good black guy who works hard, keeps his head down, and goes to church. That's... I like hookers and I like to drink. Leave me alone. I'm, you know, if... I don't care who's trying to mold me into what they want, whether they are white or black. I want to be me. And that's kind of what Jack Johnson is. It's like pure individual...
Those are my politics.
Thank you. Cool. Thank you. All right. Let's go. My man Buddha.
Loved this weekend. I'm super happy to be here. I think in a lot of ways what landed me here was realizing in 2016 that there was a disconnect. I live in a pretty liberal bubble, hang out with a lot of spiritual hippie entrepreneurs, have learned a ton from feminism, and so one of the things that I loved about this weekend and is a through line and also connects to the American Indian stuff we were talking about is really seeing the long story of liberalism. And I'm a map maker. I always think about this. So seeing the long story of both conservatism and liberalism, right? And I think because I was looking for the things about liberalism that aren't working here, because I know the things about conservatism more that don't work just because the last 4 years of my life or so. I'm really curious as a thought experiment. We talked about how like 1880 or so progressivism started, anything that had to do with kind of changing people into assimilating them. That's a very liberal feeling thing that's still going on today. We touched a little on what it would have been like if things swung conservative, But I'm curious, as a thought experiment, like, how would we, like, where would things have gone if it, instead of a liberal world order, it became a conservative world order? Like, and again, assuming that both are equally bad when taken to the extremes that they've been taken, but I'm just curious, as a thought experiment, like, where might that have gone? I'm curious to hear what you'd say on that.
I mean, so one of you said earlier this weekend that isn't progressivism actually conservatism, because it's attempting to maintain what exists, to conserve what's here, meaning traditional American culture, but also to expand it, right? So that's not the conservative part, but there's something conservative about wanting everyone to live the way that we think we have always lived traditionally, right? There's a conservative feeling in that. By the way, a lot of native activists talk just like that, right? It's very, there's a profound conservatism in a lot of native politics, I have found. Back to the land, we, our origins, roots, it's all about history. It's about we're a place in this place. It's utterly conservative. It's about not changing the past, right? So to me, progressivism, in a sense that he's been describing, this assimilationist moment, this intense assimilationist moment at the turn of the century, was conservative in that way. It was trying to make everyone be like George Washington, trying to make everyone in the world be old-fashioned, everyone in the world have the wigs and the robes and all the rest of it to look like the rest of us, right? So it's like a radical expansionist conservatism. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, go. Yeah. Let me just maybe clarify the question a little better. So in one of the things I noticed about, and it has, it's all relative too. So the conservatism of 1880
sure.
would have to be compared to the liberalism of 1880. Otherwise it would be hard. So the conservative answer to the question of, okay, there's immigrants coming in, they're different. Liberals say, let's assimilate them, make them like us. Conservatives say, let's just put them on the other side of town or not let them in the first place and live separately. I'm kind of oversimplifying it, but maybe that's...
And even that's messy, right? Because culturally speaking, that would be what you're saying, right? The conservative, fuck the immigrants, don't come in, stay out, screw you. But then there's the conservative as in business conservative. That's like the conservative politics tied to business interests who need cheap labor. Who then, wait, no, time out. We want those damn immigrants in because we need the cheap labor. Oh, wait, but we don't like them. So we'll ban this guy. Let's take somebody else. Let's, you know, the Chinese, too many of them have come now. Fuck the Chinese, we don't like them. Chinese Exclusion Act. But we still need cheap labor. Okay, we'll get them from this other country. Oh, but we don't like these guys either because we forgot they were racist. So, okay, let's ban these guys. Yeah, but we still need cheap labor. So we need to get them. And so there's this vicious cycle. And it's not, you know, one is money. It's it is tied to conservative politics because the business interest of the times, but is clashing with the other side of the conservative politics that is purely in cultural terms, you know? And I think that's part of why, and I don't mean to go on a tangent on this because I know you're asking a specific question and I'm kind of going in a whole other, but like in some way I find it's a topic that keeps showing up in my way of thinking now. Vocabulary is tricky because sometimes we use words that are so insanely complicated because they have many different meanings, but the word is one and we think that it has one clear meaning. And we get into discussion thinking that we're all using the word in the same way. And we, you know, if somebody tells me left wingers are, and whatever they are going to say is probably going to be partially true and partially bullshit. Right winger, same thing, you know, feminism, socialism, you know, a lot of the, my issue sometimes is, how about we discuss specific issues? You know, tell me one particular issue. Let's talk about the pros and cons of the different positions on that. Because my problem sometimes with describing things with words that we use all the time, but they are those inevitable generalizations to try to capture a whole movement, is that there is no such thing as a uniform position among all the people who fall under that label. You know, if you look at Christianity today, there are like 30,000 denominations of Christianity, literally, like not even like vague, like around 30,000 denominations. There are gay Christians and people who think that homosexuality is the worst thing in the world. There are super liberal Christians and super conservative Christians. The only thing they all have in common, they all think Jesus is cool. That's it. Even how they think of Jesus varies. Some they think he's a god, some they think he's a... So the thing is, when if I use the word Christian, what the fuck am I really talking about? Which one of these? Because of course they are very different from one another, you know? So I struggle with it because of course we have these words for a reason, right? They are trying to capture a reality there and we are trying to use it because, and it's useful to generalize sometimes, you need it. But it's very easy to go past that point where we end up with the everybody who is not these must be a communist then. And it's like, no. The meaning of that is something else. And so I feel that sometimes when, as much as humanly possible, I try not to think in terms of, like, for example, liberalism, conservatism. I try not to think in those terms because the reality is that give me the most conservative person in the world or most liberal person in the world, there's going to be at least some way in which they don't fit the mold of what I think is a liberal or a conservative, let alone the fact that there are many people who are not the most extreme who are going to maybe fit it 30% and not in another way and so on. So this is kind of like my cop-out answer to say I struggle with terms that have a meaning that sometimes we may go on a long discussion where we're really talking about different things using the same word. That become one of my concerns with emphasizing political ideologies in a big scale way, as opposed to in specific case, specific instance, what are we arguing about it? Okay, you can draw some clear lines of who's on one side and who's on the other. But when it comes to more general, that's just me. I struggle with it.
So I want to hear, Buddha, you say, I'm not sure you've been satisfied with an answer.
Not yet, but I'm satisfied with being unsatisfied moment.
I mean, yeah. That was an important answer. I'm not sure your question's been addressed.
Yeah, sure. No, so
I might not be sure what it is. So can you do it again?
Yeah. I think whatever we call it, and clearly, you know, all these names and political parties have changed so many times that they don't even represent something, but there's a through line that, you know, in studying your work and being here, there's just a through line of these two energies that, and I'm just calling one conservative, one liberal, and they seem to match out at least since 1800s. They seem to be matches up with those words. I don't really care if they do in terms of politically, but there's like two approaches, you know? And I think at least what we're arguing this weekend that in the progressivism movement, that one has been maybe a slightly more prevalent in the US, whatever. I think that's a really interesting point. And if there's anything we can learn from today's political climate or any political climate is like, if we can understand what's really good about both sides, we might be able to actually have a shot at getting a solution. And if we've overcompensated to a liberal degree in some areas with that's someone's opinion, whatever, you know, like what would it have like, you know, okay, we see how the liberal stuff maybe went right and wrong. And I've been thinking to myself like, okay, if a conservative approach would be, okay, there's the American Indians. Let's not try to assimilate them. Let's give them some land, but let's stay separate from them. Now, like there's ways that, again, that racism and awfulness would have come out, you know, because one of the nice things about, let's say, a city, when you go to New York and you see like just different minority groups and white people just hanging out like there's nothing between them, you go, oh my God, people can just hang out. Like that's cool. And that's a result of kind of forcing that assimilation some ways. And so there's benefits to that. And there's also lots of shitty things to it. And so I wonder what, like, you know, how we can take the good from that a quote unquote conservative approach would be a bit of a keep them on their side of the playground. You're on our side. Like what would be really good about that? And what would it have been like if we had taken that road?
Yeah. I think there've been not two energies and not two sides the way I see it anyway. So what I've been presenting to you guys in large part this whole weekend is the inception of and development of an ultimate hegemony of what we now call progressivism. And so that sounds sort of strange to a lot of people now because it's Donald Trump's president and the Republican Party is very powerful. But actually, if you look at the policies of the Republican Party other than Trump for decades and the Democratic Party, they look awfully similar. And on foreign policy, they are identical.
Yeah, with you on that for sure.
They have been identical for a century. Okay, so that's the global liberal project that has been successful. It dominates not just this country, but the world. Not every single aspect of it, but we are a global superpower with particular rules that were established by people like Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson at the turn of the 20th century, right? So that has been called progressivism, that 20th century project, that has been called the cathedral by certain people on the alt-right. I think they got that right. It is a cathedral. It's got architecture. It's structured. It's planned out. It has ornaments. It's pretty.
It's sacred.
It's sacred.
Yeah,
is the word.
Right.
Exactly. And so, to me, that's one energy,
yeah.
Right? That's the big energy. That's the winning energy over the last 100 years.
Yeah.
And then on the other side is, are you ready?
Yeah.
Everyone else. Okay. So not everyone has been down with that project. And not everyone has been down with that project in the same way. There have been all sorts of resistance to that liberal project over the last 100 years. You know, Crazy Horse was kind of a pre-resistance to it, right? Jack Johnson was the first resistance to it in some ways, right? The Vietnamese in the 1960s and 70s were another resistance to it, right? Sex workers who are now operating openly like Maggie McNeil, that's another resistance to it. Conservatives who used to say we shouldn't go conquer the Philippines or Cuba because they're brown and we don't like those races, that's another resistance to it. It's a racist one, but it's still a resistance to it, right? Mm-hmm. I don't share any of those things with those particular conservatives, but I certainly can share their opposition to the cathedral,
right?
To imperialism, to expanding this way of life as we imagine it at the point of a gun across the globe, right? It's been resisted by all kinds of people for all sorts of reasons, not two energies. It's been one versus everyone else.
And is that cathedral there because, I mean, we've equated liberalism with imperialism, and I think that there's a very important connection there, but is it the cathedral because of liberalism or because it's been the dominant narrative, right?
They won World War I, and then they won World War II, and then they built their cathedral on the battlefield. They won the war. That's what happens, right? It's not a negotiation. I don't ask. You don't walk around. They didn't come and say, Crazy Horse, can we please have your land? And he said, let me think about it. I'll get back to you in a minute. No, there's a war and there's a winner and a loser, and the winner builds the cathedral and the schools and takes their children.
Right.
Right.
So, and what would it look like if
Crazy Horse had won?
The other energy won? I get that.
Well, no, if the Lakota and Crazy Horse had won, I mean, it was probably impossible, but let's just say they did with their 30,000 warriors or whatever it was, right? And they held a piece of territory in Montana. Okay. It's possible. It could have happened. Okay. Well, I guess we would have a sovereign nation there. Okay, and then my question that I never got to with Daniele is that, and this is really a question I've been having because I've been studying the Nez Perce and the chase of the Nez Perce basically over the Canadian, you know, Chief Joseph, I will fight no more forever, the famous thing. They were dreamers, meaning they were into the dreamer religion, which was a traditionalist native religion, which rejected modern civilization and modern culture, and in fact was quite militant about it, am I right? So I wondered if the Indian, the native tribes within, internally, in particular when they had their own sovereign territory, did they start to look a lot like our Puritans? Because a lot of the native culture, the dreamer religion, and ghost dance too, was about rejecting the hedonism of modern American and Western life. And it was about living close to the soil, about living literally in the soil. It was about only having a teepee. How houses were the white man's thing. Automobiles and railroads were the white man's thing. We live close to the earth, simple, almost like animals. Human beings, but with really simple needs, right? It's an asceticism. It's a form of Puritanism, I think. Mm. And I have to imagine that there was a whole lot of, I don't know. You're the expert, Daniele, but I have to imagine there was a whole lot of policing inside the tribes that looked a whole lot like the way we police ourselves inside America. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
I see what you're saying.
Now, that's a question I have, and I'm now going to ask it to you, the expert on Native American history.
I think there's a ton of variation happening there. Like, for example, one of the things that always fascinated me was the clash between Europeans and Natives when it came to attitudes about sex. And what I came to realize was that the ultra-Puritan version of Christianity that came in early on, that had very clear-cut attitudes about sex, was one thing. But what was being compared to was 10,000 things, because there was no uniform native. There were native cultures who were ridiculously Puritan. There were native cultures that were ridiculously in a free love, no rules, whatever the fuck. There was everything in between. And so I get the feeling that, like, in native society, like pretty much anywhere else, you would find all of those things. You would find strict, almost Puritan-like thing they are describing.
you would find something that is nothing to do with it. And just about, so in that sense, when he speaks about different energies, there would be different energies among those folks in a tribe of, forget between different tribes, but even within the same tribe, you're not going to have everybody who's on board with the same mindset, who's going to be like, somebody would be like, no, I kind of like doing my teepees that way. And, you know, log houses are actually kind of cool. I like them. But that doesn't mean I want to give up all of my culture. I just like log houses, you know, or like, or so to me, it's like, that's where it gets complicated, because he's in some, it's like, for example, when he asks you that question, you clearly explain the whole progressivism side. And he's hinting also at, okay, is there something as identifiable as a conservative vibe? Whereas you are going with, no, there's a fuckload of different, anybody who's not out here is in many different things, call them conservative, call them something else. They are very different people, right? It's kind of the same thing on the Indian question you ask. It's like, the opposition to something is clear, but what all these people are about is very different from one another.
So I'm thinking about the successful tribes, the ones who built semi-civilizations. It sounds like the Lakota did. You were saying they had some things that looked like civilization, some remnants of civilization. I'm wondering how... I'm guessing that their internal policing was more powerful and more stringent than in the less successful tribes. Does that sound right?
I don't know, to be honest. I'm not sure. So I would be bullshitting you if I tell you. I think when it comes to small communities and tribes, internal policing is a big factor, because of course one of the big things is you want to fit in with your group, because if you're out, you're screwed. However, it's also very easy if you have a big enough minority to break away and start your own tribe. Whereas it's not easy in a society as we have.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think what we have here is a collection of very weak states. Does that make sense? The Indian tribes of the 19th century, a collection of very weak states. So, and the nice thing about very weak states, as we've discussed earlier, is they tend to have very weak or non-existent borders. So anytime there's going to be communities established, there's going to be internal rules, and there's no way any one of us will like all of them, right? So it seems to me the world will always be populated with many, many places that we don't want to live in, you know, with rules that we don't want to live under, right? So to me, if we're interested in human freedom that's meaningful at all, what we always need to be worried about is the boundaries, is the borders, and making sure that they are never closed to us or anyone else. Because at any moment, someone's going to draw a line around us and say, you're a member of this nation. Welcome to it. I want to be able to leave when that happens. So that's why open borders is absolutely fundamental and central in my thinking. And that's why I'm somewhat sympathetic to the at least way of life of the Indian tribes. Maybe they did it unintentionally, but they had very weak borders. So I kind of like that idea.
So does open borders conflict with the need to assimilate, though, for you? Because people don't get along, and then you can walk up to some tribe and say, hey, I want to join, but we don't like each other, and I'm not going to change. That's conflict?
Yeah, it's simple. So Danielle and I, martial arts gyms, a great, great example. If you've ever been a part of a martial arts gym, you know what it's like. It's like a good one that you've been around a long time. It's like a family. You go there, but they don't keep you there. You go and you work out and you hang out with people and you do your thing and then you leave and you can come and go as you please, right? However, here's the thing. The second we walk in the door, right? Stan's also part of this. We know there's a whole code of conduct that is really serious. And if you violate it, you're not going to be welcome there, right? If you hit a little too hard or you just don't do the thing you're supposed to do, it's danger. You're presenting danger to everyone else. So it's absolutely essential. So I assimilate. I am absolutely I'm a soldier when I'm in there, and I just take orders and that's it. I don't ask questions. I do what I'm told and I leave, and that's it. And I love it. So I assimilate like hell when I'm inside that little community for that moment, but it has open borders so I can leave.
And then what about the renegades who say, I don't like those values. I'm going to come in and smash them.
The good thing is we know how to fight.
Yeah, but
no, I'm serious. So organized self-defense is the answer to that, right? And that's it, and that's all we've got, and we might lose like crazy horse, but we also might win. We might put up so much of a fight that it's not worth their while to continue to fight us. That was exactly Chief Joseph's plan. he was hoping that he would just wear them down by riding across the country and fighting guerrilla battles whenever they could. And he was hoping that the United States Army would just give up because it wasn't worth it, because they were this little tribe from Oregon trying to flee across the border to Canada. Turns out that this was the end of the Indian Wars, and they had to make sure, meaning the U.S. cavalry, had to make sure this really was the end. So they chased those Indians all the way from Oregon through Montana to the Canadian border and finally captured them. And that's when Chief Joseph said, "I will fight no more forever." However, he might have made it. He could have made it. If he had made it, he was within just a few miles of the Canadian border, that tribe, the Nez Perce. If they had made it across that border into Canada, which was, again, a very weak state at that time in the 19th century, Canada had very little interest or ability to wipe out that tribe in that part of Canada. If they had just made it another 20 or 30 miles, there may have been a Nez Perce community to this day that was independent and autonomous. However, because they were dreamers, part of the dreamer religion, I am concerned that they would have been puritanical as shit, and I would have no interest in living there. So there you go. It's nothing but contradictions, Buddha. That's all we got for you.
Yeah, no, it's great. And maybe the overall problem, too, is like this idea of a huge nation is just not going to, like, that's, if we actually localize and went down to, you know, 150 person communities and did like that stuff, would kind of sort itself out, but it's almost not possible to negotiate it within a large federal
government. If the biggest, scariest tribe was 30,000 people, you know, that's a world we want to live in.
Yeah. I mean, I live in an intentional community. I get it. Like, that's, yeah, tribal living is absolutely of huge value.
If that's
of mine,
the biggest entity with guns in the world, then we're good. Compared to 350 million people with nuclear missiles.
Right.
Right.
It changes.
And there's more than one of those, by the way, you know?
Yeah.
That's not such a safe world to live in.
Yeah.
The Indian world of the 19th century was a much safer, believe it or not, was a much safer world, partly, mostly, almost entirely because of the lack of a state, a strong central state.
Yeah. I'm with you on that. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good. Now you can go.
Go no state. Yay.
Just remember, go Redskins. Yeah. One more. We got time for one more. Maybe two. We'll see. Ben or Stan, you can fight it out or not.
I'll try and be brief. So two overarching questions that plague me are where to from here and how to live. They're not very original questions, but it's a good place to ask those. As you can hear from my accent, I've come quite a distance to...
From San Diego all the way?
That's right. All the way. I walked all the way
good
here.
Good for you. Thank you for coming.
A long time. A big part of that is because one of the great things about America is this sort of vigorous subcultures like this that are living and working vocally in resistance to the kind of problems that we've talked about. So I'm interested in a prediction from both of you, perhaps some more from Daniela on Nietzsche, because I have heard he's someone you know something about. And to begin with, I'll just tell you something of the background of my thinking. I was training as a psychiatrist and found myself coming to the same conclusions that the so-called anti-psychiatrists did, and as such became a psychoanalyst, or I'm in the process, the very decade-long process of that. The orientation that I'm thinking from, among many other thinkers, draws from a kind of radical individualism that is a reading of Nietzsche anyway. And it's not something I've heard spoken about particularly clearly or openly in American culture and American, you know, the sort of podcast network. And this is just one small way to plant that if you've got something to say about that. The other is I find myself becoming very aggravatedly pessimistic about where society is going. All the tides just seem to be going in the wrong direction, apart from little pockets like this. But to both of you who have several decades of historical study and experience, do I need to just chill out and, you know, let the wave pass?
Oh, no, you should be really worried right now. That's what I've been trying to tell you.
Hmm.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that you should be really worried and really happy at the same time. I mean, these are just two objective facts, you know, within the world we operate in. Just postmodern break here moment. You know, we can take a recess from postmodernism, you know, the objective world we live in. Is that the United States can kill everyone on Earth 10 times over in 5 minutes. Okay, that's just a fact. And also, we are all living better materially than ever before. By far. By way far. I have a podcast. I'm broadcasting all kinds of people. Daniele has a podcast, broadcasting all kinds of people. 10 years ago, as I told you guys, we didn't have a pot to fucking piss in. Okay. Thank you, technology and capitalism, for that. Our careers, our lives, our happiness, everything, our identities are now bound up in this thing that wouldn't have existed without capitalism and technology and the advance of those things, which I'm pretty sure will continue to advance so long as those goddamn missiles don't go off. No, I mean it. That's it. It really comes down to that. I think we're good so long as we don't go to war. But the thing is, some of us are headed really fast toward war. And the rest of us are on our smartphones and don't want war, but we really like all this technology stuff. It's the best time and the scariest time in human history to me.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to use the past. You know, usually you say, oh, you use history to learn the lesson from the past, to apply to today. Today's world is unlike anything that has ever happened before. You know, the amount of change that took place in the last 150 years is greater than the amount of change that took place in the 10,000 years before that. We don't fucking know what we're doing. You know, it's like we're improvising with technologies that are awesome, but they are happening too quickly. Like the rate of innovation is faster than the human mind can grasp and our habits can grasp and our ability to figure out how to use things in a healthy, like take social media. I like social media. There's a lot of cool people I've met thanks to social media. At the same time, it happens so damn quick that most of us have no fucking idea how to use it in a healthy way and become this addictive time suck where you're glued to the opinions of people you'll never meet and you're like, why the fuck am I wasting my... And it's, is it good, is it bad? It's both, right? It's both at the same time, and it's happening so quick that it's kind of hard to figure out. It's very hard to predict because, again, it's unlike anything that's ever happened before. There are, as Ted points out, there are some awesome things happening today. While being alive today in this place here and now is a very cool thing. There are also existential threats that would have not existed 5,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago or 300 years ago. From war to fucking up the basic resources that make life possible to everything else. There are a lot of things that we can, you know, tomorrow a comet hits and wipes out the electrical grid and you have The Walking Dead becomes a documentary, right? It's like it's... That's why I'm interested in how do we take the best of what we got today and start closing those gaping holes that are threatening our very existence, because that's kind of annoying. So I would rather, and to me, that's where it becomes the worthwhile project, is how do we create, I'm not a let's go live in the past, and I'm not this is the best ever, fuck anybody who criticizes, both are real. There are things today that are amazing and we should keep having. How do we make them healthier? How do we make them less potentially threatening? How do we make other aspects of modern civilization that come as a package less problematic? That to me is the question. It's like the creative question of where we go as a culture. How do we create and shape the culture in a way that's more... we don't give up any of the good stuff we enjoy, while at the same time we inch away at all the stuff that's horrendously damaging to the human psyche and to our very and the possibility of our future existence. That's to me is where it's at, and I don't think there's a clear-cut answer of how, you know, one quick way of if we just do this everything is gonna work. It's like it's a complicated mess for sure.
And are there any thinkers like Nietzsche or others for that matter that we should read if we're sort of so inclined to try and find a way?
I mean, Nietzsche fits the path. What was I saying about Theodore Roosevelt, right? He's mentally deranged. I like Nietzsche. He's mentally deranged. It's like there's just like anybody who's a bit mentally deranged. I always find it funny when I read people who look at Nietzsche like as a perfectly coherent system. I'm like, the guy didn't fucking know what he was saying half of the time, but half of the time he was a fucking genius and these quotes are brilliant, you know. It's like, but to overstructure it and assume that he had all, no, he didn't, you know. He had amazing intuitions that I think are brilliant. And but yeah, I'm an equal opportunity, like, let's borrow from whatever source it takes. If it makes human beings happier right here, right now, I'm down. Don't care where the idea comes from. Clearly some sources are better than others, certainly. There's no one source that has them all, that is like, oh, that one source, everything about it is amazing.
You know, so I'm like, okay, let's Nietzsche, crap. Oh my God, this is amazing. Let's take this. But I don't want the other rest of Nietzsche. Okay. It's again that MMA approach to life, like take what is useful, reject what is useless. Good old Bruce Lee.
Totally, yeah. So what was your question about individualism in Nietzsche?
I guess it's coming from the concept of my reading anyway, of his concept of the Übermensch, which was not like his sister's or Hitler's reading of that particular formation, which is the idea of becoming one's most authentic and ultra individual self, being going as far as possible to pursue your destiny is such a cliched word, but what is it that you truly desire, that you're truly capable of and driven and compelled towards and working towards that? In the same way that he said there was only one Christian and he died on the cross. You know, Nietzsche had a lot of respect for Jesus. It was just Christianity that he had the problem for, because of, as one within his own writing, contradictory example of how to live the most deeply authentic life possible, but not attempting to resemble or fit in with any others, but nor solipsism or alienation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Nietzsche Übermensch thing is the most famous part of his philosophy. That's the one thing. If anyone knows something about Nietzsche, that's what they know, the Superman Übermensch thing. I think it's overplayed. I don't see much of it in his work, and I think it's actually not really consistent with what I read. But again, I think Daniele is right. The guy is not always entirely coherent either. However, I'll give you one line. Do you know what Nietzsche said about all books are? All books. Do you know what he said about them? They're all autobiographies. Every book ever written is an autobiography. You're simply writing about yourself, even if you're writing about Crazy Horse or Jack Johnson or prostitutes in the 19th century. I'm writing about myself and I'm writing history. Of course I am. Where else do those words come from but inside my mind? I don't have some direct portal to history and I pull those people and I put them in the page. I'm making stuff up based on what's written by other people from their minds. And where did they get those ideas and those words and those numbers and those statistics and that piece of evidence from the 18th century and the 16th century and 400 BC? Other people, right? So what Nietzsche was saying is that there really is no such thing, I think, other than you. You, that's it. Now, as to authenticity, I don't recall him ever really defining that. That's one of my least favorite words, is authenticity. I'm not sure he even used that word. If he did, I don't know who the translator was, and I don't like them because I don't see him actually looking for that. Maybe he does. What I see him is being a radical individualist, meaning there are a billion books, and what he's saying is that there is a billion different stories, a billion different individuals, and that's all he sees. I just see he was, to me, the precursor to Foucault and Derrida and all these people who are basically, to me, putting aside the idea that there are these overarching things that connect all humans or groups of human beings into groups, right? Collects them according to their skin color or their beliefs or where they're from. He said, no, we're just all writing our autobiographies. And not just those of us who write books, but all of us, I think he said, are writing our own autobiography. Every word out of our mouth is nothing but an autobiography. He would say what Daniele's lecture about the history of Crazy Horse and Jack Johnson was his own autobiography. It wasn't really, really about anything real and objectively true about those people. It was obviously his interpretation of history, right? And that's all it ever is what he said. To me, that in itself is a radical opening to freedom and individualism that you're talking about, I think. Does that make sense?
Sure. Thank you.
You're more than welcome. Thank you. And thanks for coming all the way from San Diego. I know it's a terrible drive, especially at this time of day. Let's do it, Dan. Come on up. And that will be the final one. But you don't have to rush. We're good.
Okay. I think it's going to be short. When you're talking about going native and not them not wanting to go back to civilization, a lot of times they were apprehended and they didn't want to come back. Couldn't that just simply be explained by Stockholm Syndrome and identifying with their kidnapper?
Yeah, but it's one of those things that there are some of those things that are like, when you say the words, they think like, oh, it means... And then you stop. It's like, wait, what exactly is like something like Stockholm Syndrome? It's kind of like saying, fuck, I'm forgetting the word right now. You know, like when you think that you are, you take a placebo. Oh yeah, the placebo effect, right? Something like, so it's like, think about it. The placebo effect is pure magic, right? It's right. like you're not taking anything chemically that's altering, and suddenly right. your mind makes it so
well,
that you're
the mind,
totally,
magic.
And it's okay. weird. And yeah. so in that sense, like Stockholm syndrome is like, it's a weird one because where do you draw the line between, hey, I'm exposed to some shit that's actually, I like it, and given the circumstances and given my options, I actually think this is a healthy and good choice for him. And where is it a syndrome? You know what I mean? Right. It's like, it's
yeah.
like,
it's not, you can't define
in
it.
In that sense, almost every human choice is like, where do you yeah. determine how much is it just pure normal free will of a person and how much is circumstances pushing you in a certain direction? I think it's interesting. Like, for example, there's one, there's a historical example of this that I find brilliant because it's two Spanish guys who shipwreck on the coast of Mexico before Cortes shows up several years before. Both of them are captured by the same Maya group. Both of them escape, are captured by a different Maya group. They live a few miles apart in two different tribes. Cortes shows up 8 years later, run into one of them. Guy's like, ah, oh, thank you, you're saving me, bringing back to Spain. I've survived all these years, yes. But we should go, God, my buddy was here and I haven't seen him for a little bit, but... And they go and they find this dude who's covered in tribal tattoos from head to toe. He's like... I got three beautiful Maya kids. I have a hot Maya woman. I'm pretty happy here, man. He's like, so say hello to Spain. And he's like, how can you lose your soul for... He's like, dude, what are you talking about? I'm happy, you know? And he's like, and this is where it gets interesting to me, the individuals, right? Because we think the Spaniards in the 1500s. There were no the Spaniards in the 1500s. There were a bunch of people who, despite growing up in the same culture, react to the same stimulus in completely different ways. One guy cannot wait to go home and be saved.
Right.
The other guy is like, you know what? This life is a lot more to my taste. And so, see you guys. And that's what I find fascinating, that not two people react the same way to things.
Okay. Well, I guess maybe Hattie Hearst would be a more clear example. I'm not sure.
Yeah, even that, you know, I know the story, but I haven't studied enough, like, what exactly went through her, like...
Right.
I haven't studied enough to understand their psychology. Right. Yeah, exactly.
Syndrome,
yeah. yeah. And I think that's the difference, that in some of these communities, you see the obvious appeal.
Right.
You know, you come from this highly stratified society where maybe you are an indentured servant and all you can look forward to is just being worked to death by your owners. Or I can go here, and if they don't torture me to that, they adopt me and they love me and I have a ton of freedom.
Yeah, dances with wolves.
Fuck this. I like this better. Yeah. You know, it's like... It's, yeah, that's where in some places the objective facts out there are a little more, they are easier to understand for why somebody would make that choice.
Okay.
Other cases, you're like, yeah, who fucking knows why that person chose it. But in some cases, the elements are there.
Okay, so it's safe to assume they just liked it.
Again, it happened to thousands of people.
Right.
I think there were very different reasons. Somebody maybe was purely scared and was so intimidated that I'm like, if I become just like my captors, I'm gonna be safe.
Right.
I'm sure it happened. Somebody was like, this is fucking heaven. That's the life I've always wanted and I didn't even know I missed. This is perfect. It suits my personality. And there were probably about 100 other variations in between those two. You
okay,
know?
All right. So it's just much more complicated than that.
I think.
All right, cool. Excellent. Thank you.
Dan, you know this. Everything's more complicated. Come on now.
No, I mean, I like the idea of it. It's, you know, joining a hunter-gatherer society. It sounds amazing. That was just, you know, oh, this is the argument I could see against it. I just wanted to know how to disarm it, but yeah.
No, it's a crucial question. All right, I'm going to go off. I'm going to do a little tangent maybe, but not. I don't know. We'll see. I'm going to tell you a story, okay? I told them a story about the Edelweiss pirates in Nazi Germany, the teenagers who ran into the hills and fought the Nazis and the Gestapo in the streets and refused to be inducted into the Hitler Youth or into the Wehrmacht to fight in that war. They took their guitars and they went into the hills and they just sung songs and they played and they danced. The Edelweiss pirates, they were known as, that was the first group they were established in, I think, in the Ruhr Valley. But the biggest and most militant and most aggressive of the Edelweiss pirates groups was the one in Cologne in Germany. Cologne, of course, during the war, was a major industrial military production center, which got bombed relentlessly round the clock by the Allies for four straight years. Many of the Edelweiss pirates were killed in those bombing raids. The Cologne group of Edelweiss pirates had a different name. They did not call themselves pirates. They chose a different name because they had watched a lot of American movies, and they had read a lot of American dime novels, and they identified with one group. They did not identify with cowboys. They called themselves the Cologne Navajo.
Yeah.
And then there were the Frankfurt Apaches,
right,
and the Berlin Indians. They identified with the savages, mm-hmm, not with the cowboys chasing them, right? And I just, when I found that out, you know, I mean, to me, that's a globalism I can get behind, mm-hmm, right? Did you know about that? Did you know that they identified?
Yeah, it's awesome. It makes perfect sense, sure. But it's, yeah, that's awesome. And I think, you know, when you say, I'm interested in those contradictions that seem to be contradiction, but to me it's like a yin-yang balancing of opposites. I'm interested in tribal culture within a global context. Mm. How can I travel all over the world and have access to a whole bunch of shit while at the same time having a tight-knit community? Boom. I like that. I like when he was talking about individualism. Individualism is awesome. And I also like community life.
Me too.
And to me, it's like, it's very rarely this or that. It's usually, how do I balance the two in a way that works? And again, it's not theory. It's like, if you go surfing, it's not that, oh, if you lean 60% to the right and 40% to the left, then you found the right exact balance. Yeah, for that 1 second when the wave is that way. The next second, you need to go 80% to the left and 20 to the right. And to me, it's how most things are. Is anytime somebody asks me to make a choice between this or that, I feel like it's a trap. That's bullshit. This is not a good choice. It's this and that. In exact what balance, we have to figure out. And that's constantly changing.
And we think too damn much, you and me. And the rest of us. We need to think less and try more.
And surf more.
Yeah. We're only about 3 miles from the ocean. We should just go surfing right now. It is raining, but so what? Hey, wait, it's the Super Bowl, though. We got to go watch TV instead. Daniele, thank you. You're a friend and a hero and a great podcaster. And thank you so much for being here. And thank you for the amazing questions and one of the greatest weekends of my life. Thank you so much, everybody.
This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To support the show and become a member of the Unregistered community, go to unregisteredunderground.com. To get information and to buy tickets to the Renegade University weekend events in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., go to thaddeusrussell.com/courses. Thanks for listening.